You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Flashpoints, a close-range border patrol assassination of an undocumented woman in Rio Bravo. Disgraced racist Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio shows up at an anti-immigrant rally in Southern California. We'll be reporting on that, and we'll be bringing you firsthand information about that assassination at the border. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilan Molina, and we're hoping that Davey D will join us in just a little bit. And please stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is from the London Independent. It's the best version of what happened from the corporate press. A U.S. Border Patrol agent has fatally shot a migrant near the U.S.-Mexico border. U.S. Customs and Border Protection said the incident took place on Wednesday afternoon near Laredo, Texas, in a border town about 7 miles away called Rio Bravo. The officer was responding, he said, to illegal activity. We all know what happened next. Border Patrol guy, I guess, panicked and shot a few people. He actually shot and murdered one young woman. In the videotape we're about to hear, we started a little bit late, so you don't hear this. But in the tape, this you can hear the officers saying to the survivors of their attack and their shooting, see what happens? This is what happens with you people. See? Let's listen to a videotape that was recorded by a woman who heard the shots inside her house where the murder took place, maybe 7 feet away from her door. Let's run it.
I heard a shot. Nobody go out. Nobody go out. Oh, my God. Bring the girls in. Give me your hand. Give me your hand. Why are you treating her so badly? Why did you shoot the girl? You killed her. He killed the girl. She's dead. You took the gun, bro. You killed that girl. She's there. You shot her in the head. I heard it. I was in my room and I heard it and I came out here.
Just sort of walking through the backyard to get a better shot.
Tasers. Balazo en la cabeza. Como chingón, ¿dónde están tasers?
Jeez, why? They shot her in the head. Why didn't they use tasers?
¿Está en la esquina?
No, I'm in the corner.
Pues salen. ¿Cómo le van a disparar a una chava en la cabeza?
Come on, guys. How could you shoot the girl in her head?
No, la mataron.
You killed her. You shot her.
Thank you, ni que nada. En vez de que nos estén protegiendo.
You're not protecting us. You think you are. Jesus, go get her. Come, Antonio. Please tell him to quiet down. The poor girl, they shot her in the head. Just because they were running. They didn't make any yelling or
comments. He lives over here.
They just shot her.
Vente.
Come here,
Junior,
come here.
Vente.
Come here, chulo, come here. Unbelievable, they just killed a girl. Come here, my son, come here.
You interfere, they're going to be arrested, okay? I'm just telling you.
No les estoy diciendo nada. Simplemente me da coraje porque dispararon a una chava.
How could you kill the young girl?
No le estaban haciendo nada.
Come on.
Okay.
She didn't do anything.
Investigation, okay? Just wait.
Me pongan cordón aquí porque voy a salir, voy a un...
I'm sorry, I live here. Like, I don't know.
Bueno,
we have to move everything. They're going to come.
That is the testimony, and it comes from a videotape, a tape from Martha Martinez. She's a woman who lives near the scene. She posted the video on Facebook. Though the agency said the officers were investigating activity in a culvert, Ms. Martinez said there is no culvert on the property. She also noted the group of migrants did not have any objects that looked like they could have been used as weapons against the officer. Now, this is the new world order under Donald Trump. We're lucky to have Miguel Gavilán Molina here with us, who not only grew up on both sides of the border and knows this region very well. I mean, this is a place where immigrants and people fleeing U.S. violence created by free trade and wars, this is a place where people die all the time, isn't it, Miguel?
Absolutely, Dennis. I mean, every year, and there are interfaith groups that deal with the crossing at the border. You know, there are people that are shot, murdered, killed, and up to anywhere from 400 to 600 to 800 people die every year on the U.S.-Mexican border. Most of them die from sunstroke, dehydration, and so forth. But there is a percentage that dies from gunshot wounds. Sometimes people are found dead, riddled with bullets, and who knows. There are vigilante groups that have made it their mission to go after undocumented folks and supposedly turn them over to the INS, but a lot of times those people are shot. But what you see here, Dennis, is simply the president of this country emboldening, you know, the INS, emboldening the Border Patrol. A month ago or so ago, he mobilized the National Guard, you know, putting hundreds of soldiers on the border. Well, that's a signal to these Border Patrol officers that now the border is militarized. Soldiers aren't there to check your papers. They're not there to, you know, protect you. They're not there to provide your security. Soldiers are sent to an area to kill.
And they killed.
I mean, this is just a case that we've learned. But there's been other incidents of innocent people being shot to death. And again, this is the president of this country emboldening the INS, the Border Patrol, and the militarized personnel at that, you know, U.S.-Mexican border. It's okay to shoot brown people, to shoot Mexicans. They're animals after all.
And that's Miguel Gavilán Molina. I'm Dennis Bernstein. A moment, we're going to be joined by David D. This is the last hour we have to ask you to support that kind of work. Now, there is no way that Miguel and I could have turned our eyes from this story. There is simply no way. So here we are. I have to make a decision on the last day. Is it all fundraising or do I continue the message with Miguel and with David? Do we continue to do the work and risk and take the risk that you will stand up? Now, you know the kinds of things we have been sharing with you in terms of the kinds of thank you gifts. We have a Flashpoints $1,000 package that has voices that change the world. That's the USB with thousands of voices for a $200 contribution. That's the PRA Voices That Change the World USB, $200. We have the Doctrine of Discovery, $100. The 3-DVD set Capitalism, $240. We've got the Spring Pack for $150. We've got the whole Robert Perry retrospective. We got all that for $1,000. But you know what? What we have here at KPFA and Pacifica Radio is, I'm not going to say somebody like Miguel Molina, because there's nobody like him. And we have somebody, it's not like Davey D. He is an original who presents an extraordinary alternative information flow that comes out of, really out of the hip-hop world and out of communities that are often disenchanted, disparaged, undermined, and shot if they complain, just like the Salvadorans coming over the border. So listen, folks. This is the last hour. This is our last hour here. And I really would like to see you stand up for that. The opening of the show today, did that mean something to you? Did we do the right thing by giving, putting the spotlight on that point on the border to explain that this is the beginning? This is only the beginning of the Trump world. And they will not, the corporate media will not cover this story. All they want to do is scandal and Donald. Scandal and Donald. Sex and Donald. Sex and prostitutes and Donald. They forget about the incredible famines that the United States war supporting the Saudis is causing. The famines that are coming. The potential. They want to destroy the treaty with Iran. And here, at home, just like they said in the documentary that Davey presented, they used death squads in El Salvador and the Klan here in the United States. And now they don't need the Klan anymore because they've got an expanded, militarized, empowered Border Patrol. These Border Patrol people probably saw what was being condoned by the United States in terms of the slaughter in Gaza. And they said, well, if they could do it there in Gaza, if Gaza is being cheered for that slaughter, then we can kill here at the border. That is what this is about, folks. We have a few minutes to raise the goal. We are a bit behind. We need to ring those phones off the freaking hooks. 1-800-439-5732. If you have 25, we will take it. We could use, by the way, we could really use now more than ever. If you've got $1,000 or $2,500, we would like to use that as a match. And that would jump us. That would move us right along nicely. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I'm going to go out there and see if those phones are freaking ringing in the phone room. I'm hoping you're standing up for free speech radio so that we can keep doing the work that we're doing here.
Let me just say something here. When you all played that clip in the beginning of the show, there's two ways in which that clip is often presented in media. And you can, if you don't believe me, go up and down the dial. A lot of times a clip like that would be played on corporate media. And it would have an expert that would sit up there and they would use words like criminal, lawbreaker. They would have a police rep. And if you're down in L.A., and Miguel, you know, almost all those TV stations have on staff police officers, right? And they would, you know, they would say, well, this is the proper procedure, right? And basically, by the time you are done with the story, it would carry the narrative of a lawbreaker who crossed the border and the beleaguered, hardworking Border Patrol feared for their life and had to shoot her. And the conversation would then center around that. What makes this different on these airwaves is that somebody like you has come from that side of the tracks, literally, and understand there is a connection to foreign policy. There's a connection to history in which people freely go back and forth between two places because that's how they've done for generations, not to cross a border, but understanding that borders have crossed them. We also have an understanding that there's a certain amount of humanity that needs to be uplifted, that nobody was in fear of their life. But what you're talking about is somebody who was trying to make a way out of no way, coming up against a force that has now been empowered and encouraged and incentivized to shoot, kill, and get rewarded and uplifted and be seen as heroes. And so what I'm getting at is that these airwaves bring to the forefront the humanity of people who are often criminalized in the mainstream. And it's important to recognize that humanity, because a lot of times we've spent decades and generations of seeing ourselves as the other and seeing ourselves as something that is inhumane. We bring that to the forefront, our humanity.
Davey, we've got a breaking story here, and we thank you for that, but we got to keep the work going. We got our first $1,000 match. Somebody just called in $1,000 to match people who have a little bit less to give a little bit more. Now, if somebody wants to match this 1,000 with 1,000 or double it, we'll match that as well. But we're off. We're running. And also, Davey, I want to let people know that in one moment, I'm going to give the number a couple of times, and then we're going to go down to Southern California, where there's a protest going on resisting Sheriff Joe, who feels now emboldened to go on the road. He's running for office in his own state, and he's now emboldened to pass racism and fascism.
Joe Arpaio, who was pardoned.
He's down there speaking with his fist up. Free speech for Joe, but not for us. Anyway, just let me give out the number. We're in a match now. We're in a match, so every dollar that you give us now is doubled. You can hit the phone, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Or please come in and join us on the web. Come in and join us at kpfa.org. Hit the pledge button and join us. Right now, we're going to bring you a little bit more information, right? We're going down south, and we are joined now by Salvador Sarmiento. He works with the with NDLON, the National Day Labor Organizing Network, and they are on the front line of fighting this racism, this Trump version of ethnic cleansing. And let me tell you what's happening down there. There's a bit of a revolt. You can check it out. Well, as we said, there's a visit by Joe Arpaio. Right-wing officials have manufactured a revolt against sanctuary with the help of the hate groups FAIR. That's not Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. That's an anti that's a right-wing anti-immigrant group. Fox News, they've invited the proud KKK Sheriff Joe Arpaio to mobilize extremists across Orange County. Do you believe it? That's the in the age of Trump. So let's invite Salvador Sarmiento. Salvador, welcome back to Flashpoints. Salvador, are you there? I think I scared him away. We're going to get him back. Let's get him back on the phone. We had him on for a few minutes because I was trying to do the business here and juggle two things at once. But you know, if you've listened to Flashpoints, that we have a regular working relationship with NDLON. And we are deeply engaged in the Brown civil rights movement. And we complement. I think it's an incredible 1-2 punch that we share these 2 hours. It starts with Davey at 4, and then Flashpoints takes it at 5, and you get two alternative radical programs. Okay, we've got Salvador. Salvador, we're so sorry for keeping you waiting, but we're delighted to have you with us. Could you explain what the heck is going on? Joe Arpaio is really in Orange County now? What? Acting?
Is he there?
What's that?
Is Salvador there?
Salvador, are you there?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I'm
tell
here.
Us about what's going on and your reaction to it.
Sure. What we're seeing in Orange County is really kind of ground zero of a Trump-inspired attack, a fabricated revolt against pro-immigrant policies in California. You know, we've seen a series of the usual right-wing local officials in Orange County that have been, you know, passing these symbolic resolutions against the state that reject, you know, Trump's mass deportation agenda. And today we have, you know, the infamous polarizing figure, probably one of the more important symbols of hatred, of anti-immigrant hatred in the country, Sheriff Joe Arpaio from Maricopa County in Arizona, you know, brought in, invited to really try to energize these right-wing officials in Orange County.
You are there now, right, Salvador? Are you at the protest now?
I was there earlier, actually.
And what? Give us a sense of the tone of the. Did it feel like a racist performance? What are the vibrations? Would it scare people? The people that you represent?
I mean, it's really clear. I think the folks that are hosting Joe Arpaio, both the you know, congressional candidate, the of local officials, the city council members, and the mayor in the city of Yorba Linda, that are really allowing a a city community center to be used to host what is basically a pro-hate rally, you know, and everything that, that Sheriff Joe Arpaio represents is very much in line with what we've been referring to as the hate circus, this group of very aggressive white supremacists going from city to city, literally threatening community members, residents, being very aggressive, you know, saying phrases like, you know, build a wall, kill them all. That is the level of this very despicable.
Build a wall, kill them all. Build a wall, kill them all.
Exactly. That is the level of kind of despicable contempt that they have for immigrants, for refugees, for, you know, for anybody that doesn't look or talk like them. And that is the toxicity that they're trying to energize in Orange County. And if anything, they're attacking California because they know that, you know, if California holds a strong resistance, that is obviously a threat to their agenda for, you know, to accelerate deportation.
Let me just say something about Orange County, because we did a big show on
this
that
DVD
a few weeks ago with a professor that works at one of the colleges there that was being targeted in a well-orchestrated thing. One of the things that she had unearthed is that Orange County is the Silicon Valley in terms of money for these hate groups. They flock to Orange County and they get funded there. Part of the reason they do that is because L.A. and California shields them. You think of the big blue state and you overlook Orange County and you don't associate this vitriol that Salvador described coming out of Southern Cali. The reason why I bring this up, because one of the things that they're doing now is they're offering scholarships to a lot of these up-and-coming racist types to go to school. So they're showing up on college campuses, and they're pushing that agenda there. And so when you hear about Joe Arpaio going to Orange County, it's not just to have a rally there because people think like him. He's also there because that's where a lot of money is going to be funding these national campaigns that they go on. And when we had the sister on, the professor, she laid out a whole list of activities and people and organizations that are being sponsored by folks that are very rich, very wealthy in Orange County, which brings me back to the fund drive that we're here. They are very clear about putting money in the pockets of folks who are racist, who are xenophobic, who have hatred in their heart, who are Islamophobic, right down the road in Southern Cali. We're up here on this radio station, and we may just be a small dot, but we have a very powerful signal that is heard up and down the state. It is important that you support us, that you call 1-800-439-5732, that you call 1-800-HEY-KPFA or go online at kpfa.org and be just as intentional and just as enthusiastic and just as vigorous as the folks down in Orange County are with the institutions, organizations, and media outlets that they support to push forth the national agenda. That is why Joe Arpaio is in Orange County. It's not just because there may be a conservative base there. It's because that's where they're getting their money.
All right. Now, the number again is 1-800-439-5732. I'm Dennis Bernstein. We are really honored and lucky to have on the phone Salvador Sarmiento. He was at this racist Joe Arpaio rally, and he represents a group of people who are very concerned. Given the kind of racism that's being stimulated and the kind of hate that is being stimulated, Salvador, are you and the people that you work with, are you taking special protections? How are you preparing the folks to deal with this burgeoning and growing violent attack?
Yeah, that's important to say, that the hate circus that has been going from city to city, it's clearly an aggressive, and it really is not just divisive, and, you know, it's not just rhetoric. It's they're aggressive, and they're making threats, and so much so that when they when the meeting was held in the city of Costa Mesa, which has its own kind of problematic history of anti-immigrant racism, the Costa Mesa and Orange County residents that were at that meeting actually had to be escorted to their cars after the meeting because even the police officers recognized that it was not a safe situation for the Orange County residents, for the Costa Mesa residents that were being threatened by the hate circus. And it's very clear that this is a very much an orchestrated attack, you know, all the way from the Trump administration to Fox News to anti-immigrant organizations like FAIR, you know, and these activists that are getting a lot of support, these very right-wing local officials. Of course, they're going in Orange County. That's why Orange County is ground zero for Trump's attack against California. That's why Los Alamitos, your Belinda, are so important. But even in conservative Orange County, the community's consensus is still against mass deportation and against this kind of vitriol and racism. And it really is important to support those grassroots voices in Orange County that have been stepping up. Groups like, you know, it's a broad coalition. Groups like Your Belinda United, who's one of the co-hosts of the rally today. Groups like Los Alamitos Community United. Groups like Resilience Orange County. These are the community groups that are really, you know, confronting this level of hatred, and it's important to get behind them.
Well, Salvador Gavilan here, you absolutely correct, and people do need to get behind the civil rights groups, community-based groups that are out for social justice. And here is the scenario, Salvador, and I think you'll agree with me. Here we have a convicted felon, Joe Arpaio, that was pardoned by the racist bigot in the White House, Trump, pardoning him for his unbelievable treatment of brown people. And here he is now like a spokesperson in Orange County, but there is the pushback. And I was going to ask you, Salvador, in the resistance and the persistence of the resistance, you know, there's the disruption of, you know, the standard or the status quo. And there is a disruption. I feel it's going to happen here just a few days from now when we find here in California dealing with the primaries. Is Andilan and the groups that you're involved with organizing to elect officials or to change laws or to, you know, have an effect in legislation to stop this kind of racial bigotry to take root here in California?
Well, so a lot of the organizations that are at the forefront of this effort in Orange County are nonpartisan organizations, community-led organizations. But it's very clear that the reason the bigots and this, you know, Trump-inspired and coordinated attack against California, it's very clear that, one, they're attacking California because California legislation, like SB 54, the Valleys Act, what they call the sanctuary state law,
yes,
is undermining their mass deportation agenda. That's clear. But it's also clear that the right-wing Trump administration is using this to mobilize their right-wing base. That's incredibly clear. That's why they're launching out of Orange County. That's why they're, you know, orchestrating this hate circus. What's not as clear, whether, you know, the Democratic Party in California is going to get behind what the communities across California are really demanding. We say we don't just defend, you know, sanctuary. We don't just defend our immigrant community. We celebrate it. You know, we know this is a part of California. We're proud of it. And that's what California is all, you know, California Valleys is all about. We celebrate. And we're not, you know, we don't fall for Trump's trap, you know, about getting divided, you know, in California. We defy Trump's politics of hate and fear. And that's what, whether it's the elections or, you know, these grassroots pro-immigrant rights rallies need to show in Orange County that it, you know, we're not going to fall for Trump's divisive politics. We, you know, this is California. This isn't Arizona.
All right. Salvador, we thank you for joining us, for the incredibly important work you do with Andilan. We appreciate our ongoing interchange and relationship with Andilan and the kinds of information you bring from the grassroots, not to mention the representation you give to those workers who do some of the hardest work in this country. And what do they face? They face beatings, arrest, cheatings, and shootings. by out-of-control agents for the government of the United States. Thank you for joining us. Please be careful, Salvador, and know that we've got the open-door policy for you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you all. Thanks so much.
All right. Now, you are listening to a special edition of Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. I'm here with Miguel Gavilan Molina and Davey D from Hard Knock Radio. We are in our last hour. And if the work that you hear, you've heard at 4 o'clock, and that you hear now at 5 o'clock means something to you, if you really hear a difference, if that difference means something to you, if you appreciated the fact that Miguel, who is a trained translator who can actually translate spontaneously as the people, as the somebody is talking, which is amazing to me, we have his gifts here. And we could, that's why we could go right into the information, find out what was being said and what is the real story before the corporate media destroys it. And all of a sudden you're going to hear that this woman who was murdered was carrying a machete and was wielding it and trying to kill five agents. And the agents were threatened. And they, since they feared for their life, have you heard that phrase, Dave?
Yes, we have.
Since they feared for their life, they had to kill this woman close range, blow her head away. This agent shot this woman in the head. He didn't use a taser. He didn't shoot at her knee. He shot her at close range in the head. And then what did he say? Forgive me, folks, because this is really getting on my nerves. And then he said, according to the tape that was recorded by a very brave human being,
Marta Martinez,
the agent says, "See what happens? This is what happens to you people. Come on. This is the work. This is why we are here. When you talk about giving voice to the voiceless, when you talk about speaking truth to power, this is exactly what we're talking about. Let me give you the phone number, and let me urge you to stand up. By the way, we got a $1,000 match. Thank you, Marco Picone, for matching the 1,000 with 1,000. So now we were in a $2,000 match. We've got a few minutes to do it, but we're hoping that maybe somebody out there has 1,000 or 2,000. You want to double the match to 4,000? I bet you we can make that too, because I know people understand what they heard. They understand what the nature of real content is, and this audience understands how important this network is, how much it means at this point in history as we stand at the crossroads of changing history and watch this white supremacist. Remember, this is somebody whose father took him to freaking Klan rallies. Seriously, this is not just like a racist, your typical everyday American white racist. This is a serial Klansman, and somebody who puts on as their first major supporter Jefferson Beauregard's Sessions the Third, picks him as his key advisor. That's way more dangerous than what's his face from the Klan. Anyway, 1-800-439-5732. You can do it on the web. A bunch of you have. KPFA.org. Click on the pledge button and make a difference. Make sure that we can remain viable and scrappy and powerful at the roots. 1-800-439-5732. I'm going to go in and see if those phones are ringing.
Let's go for it. Let's do it. And one of the things that's really important, again, here in California, in Orange County, and that is very simple. We here in California, we are all Mexicans. We are all Muslims. We are all the new world where many worlds are possible. And we here at KPFA, we here at Flashpoints at Hard Knock, we can't take on Trump's racial hatred and bigotry without you. We need people like you to stand with us. We will take the battle to the front. We will get into the trenches as we have throughout the last 20, 30 years. And by joining us, you help us educate. You help us mobilize and get people out there to protest, engage, be proactive, and to advocate for human rights for every human being. And yes, by donating. So we need you to help us right now to donate. And sometimes you might say, you know, why should I listen? Or whether you listen a little or a lot, it doesn't matter, because right from the beginning, we know that you are the most important part of this community-oriented radio station. We know that you are listening because you want to know. There's a new world here. They're trying to take us back to the 50s. They're trying to take us back to pre, you know, civil rights. And right now we have the Brown Civil Rights Movement happening in this country since 2003, and people are beginning to realize. So we need you to go to your phones, 1-800-439-5732. We have about 5-6 people in the telephone room ready to take your calls.
There are actually 7 people there,
yes.
And 6 of them are busy, and there's 1 open line, and you can fill that now, or you can come in on the web at kpfa.org, hit the pledge button, and join us there. I want to thank Tim Owens. Thank you so much for being with us and putting your money where your beliefs are. Thank you, Norvella Brooks. Thank you so much. Thank you, Marv Reeve Freyer. Thank you so much, Catherine Guthrie. Thank you so much. Teresa McKinnon, we thank you so much. And thank you, Maria Ingerman. We thank you so much for your support. And Bill and Maria Decker, we thank you so much for your support. And please keep calling. Thank you, Anonymous. Thank you, Marco Picone. We're looking for, really, seriously, I'm not kidding, Davey and Miguel. I'm hoping... you know, because we've got to raise about $15,000 this hour to really get us close. I'm really hoping that there are a couple of people out there who have a little extra. We've got 2 beautiful $1,000 contributions. Maybe there's somebody who wants to match the 2 with the $2,000 contribution. We take that, but we'll take 25 too,
and that's doable. I mean, in the Bay Area, you have a lot of billionaires. You have a lot of millionaires. You have a lot of people who do have money. You have people who are part of institutions that could get these packages, these $1,000 packages that have all these documentaries and all these
a lot of stuff in there.
And again, you know, going back to our conversation with folks in Orange County, that is a center place. When people go there, they are funding newspapers. They're funding television stations, they're funding radio outlets, and making sure that their message is well-heeled and it's delivered to the masses. Now, in our small way, in this neck of the woods, when you call 1-800-439-5732, in our small way, when you go online and you join the others who are pledged at kpfa.org, you are part of the pushback. Not only a pushback, but more important, an empowerment of folks who really need this. I'm looking at the picture of Patrice Gonzalez, the young woman who was killed. I mean, that is heartbreaking. That is somebody's daughter. You see, I see people who look like her. I see family members who look like her. I see folks who I just came from the school who look just like her with her dress on or a little, you know, dress. This is not somebody who was a gangbanger. Remember, because we just had a president say these people crossing the line are MS-13 gangbangers and animals. That's the tone that was set, right? That was carried unchallenged by corporate media that didn't dissect that and say, well, let us dissect this and even find out how an MS-13 showed up in the first place. Can we go through the foreign policy that gave birth to it? You know, and then can we talk about the things that people were doing? Remember, we used to have Alex Sanchez come up here and talk about this, right? So when you have a station like this, you get the full story to some of these situations. So 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Pledge online at kpfa.org, but I'm just going to close. I'll pass it to you, Dennis. Lines are drawn in the sand.
Make no
mistake about it. Mercers, Heritage Foundation, right? Koch brothers. And I can start naming a whole lot more. A very clear that they are going to get their message across. They're buying up newspapers,
right,
buying up radio stations. Remember when we had the big marches in 2006?
They fund Marketplace. Right. The Koch brothers funds Marketplace.
There you go. Remember when we had all those rallies down in 2006?
Right.
Right? And remember how Spanish language radio DJs came together and got that march together?
Right.
And those corporations that they were a part of, what happened the next week? They came up. They pulled all those people in, and he said, you will never do this again. And we ain't seen nothing like that since from those folks, right? They it was called worker repression. Now, because it was Spanish language radio, and you had a lot of people that, even when they, with the best intentions, still have a xenophobic mindset, they didn't get after that. We did, but they didn't, right? Here we are seeing this full throttle. So if you want to be a part of this resistance, and resistance is also empowering people in our own community that are often marginalized and seen as other. You make that phone call this afternoon on the last day of the fund drive in the last minutes, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, pledge online at kpfa.org. If you don't, who will?
That's right.
If you don't, who will?
That's exactly right, Davey. And now is the time. We've got a few minutes left in this hour. We are trying to... What? I can't... You mean the phones went silent, did you say? Okay, we had a beautiful rush.
Wait a second.
We have raised perhaps... Okay, so we've raised $9,000 so far in the last 2 hours. We're trying to raise 20 in the last 2 hours. So we're about halfway through with about 18 minutes to go till 6 o'clock. And that means that you can now, if you couldn't get through before, or you didn't have a chance to call before, or go on the web, you can do it now. Let me tell you again, we have got amazing premiums for you. For instance, if you just, and every dollar you give us now, we're in a $2,000 match, which is quite amazing. Every dollar you give us now is doubled. So you can have voices that change the world. This is thousands of hours of the Pacifica Radio Archives documentaries and voices, incredible stuff. It's on a USB drive for a $200 contribution. You can get the Doctrine of Discovery documentary for $100. You can get the 3-DVD set Capitalism for $240. You can get the MP3 KPFA Spring Package for $150 contribution. You can get the Robert Perry 10-Hour Retrospective with Perry, Oliver Stone, John Pilger, Gary Webb, and many others. You can get all of that for a $1,000 contribution, or you can just give us $25 or $2,500 because you think this work is important. You think what you heard today on Hard Knock at 4 and Flashpoints at 5 means everything to you, and that you want to make sure that you can sustain it, you can empower us at the base, you can expand our voice, and we can keep going into the 21st century, because this radio show and this radio network is more important than ever. I consider us, I really do consider us the canary in the coal mine of corporate disinformation. Well, I now think of it as the military-industrial media complex. That's what we're standing against. This is a radio network that speaks truth to power. We are that invisible university in the airwaves. We are really an ocean of information that you all swim in. We are an ocean of alternative information that we dive into, that we grow from, that we learn with, and then we fight back with. We are a fight back community, and you know it, because the way it goes oftentimes is like there's one group of you comes in here and tries to organize the rest of you to get involved in one important issue or another. And right now I'm issuing a request to you. I'm asking you to take a moral action for Free Speech Radio, to put your money where your beliefs are, to take that action that nobody makes you take, but that your heart and that every cell, every bone in your body tells you it's the right thing to do. I am asking you to stand up now for Free Speech Radio. The phone number, I hope those, let me know if the phones don't start ringing, because I'm going to go do something terrible. 1-800-439-5732, like start yelling or something. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. What else can Davey, Dennis, and Miguel ask you to do? Miguel, the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. You can get the $1,000 pack. You can get any of the premiums you've heard, really. You can get anything that you have heard offered to you is available now. But now is the key and the operative word. Please stand up and make a difference. You can use the phone, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. You can use the phone or you can come to us on the web at kpfa.org. kpfa.org. It's all available to you, but the real ultimate premium is the open flow of information.
Absolutely. And right now, every day, we hear corruption. Corruption from the White House. We hear hatred, bigotry every day. Well, when you tune into us, we are devoted to give you the real focus, to look at what really has happened. And we're asking you to pause for a moment and consider the outrages you have been hearing from the White House, not just yesterday or the week before, but for the last almost year and a half. And our objective here is to inform you, to educate you, hopefully give you something for you to say, I'm tired of this. And we are devoted to shut down the ugly, hateful situation happening right now across the country, coming from the dark storm sweeping the country from the White House.
Okay. And a lot of that dark storm, Miguel, is big money that is going into some of those media outlets, those corporate media outlets, but it's also going to some of those politicians I mentioned earlier. The tone that is set with the passing of this Blue Lives Matter bill, right, making it a hate crime. Well, we had Keith Ellison, a progressive, go along with passing that. We had Raul Cravada down there in Arizona.
That's true.
He went along with that, right?
Yes, he did.
And we can go on and on. How does that happen? That happens when you start to have a society that moves more towards a police state. And you have folks who, when the line is drawn in the sand, make a decision. And here we made a decision that we are going to stand with the people no matter what. We are here for you. As they say in a song by Outkast, we're going to be here forever and forever and forever ever and forever. Because we are committed to this. We are part of the community. We're not away from this. We're here. We go to the Malcolm X Jazz Festival.
Right.
We will go up
to these
protests. We will broadcast live. We will go there with microphones in hand, and we seek you out to make sure that these airwaves are your airwaves. So with that being said, there are many people in our community that don't have a lot of money when they call 1-800-439-5732. I'm looking at these pledge cards. There are folks that have pledged $5. There are folks that have pledged $10. There are folks that have pledged $20. But we're also appealing to folks who do have extra income that really want to give voice to many of those who absolutely depend on the upliftment of marginalized folks in troubling situations.
Davey, we got a breaking story here. I'm sorry. We got another $1,000 match. I think people are hearing what you're saying, and they're standing up and they're wanting to make a difference. So we thank you, Steve Sarman, for challenging. Yes, I was allowed to mention you. Yes, I did it right. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Anasiato. Thank you, Thornton Woods. We thank the three of you. We've got a $3,000 match to make in we have about 10 minutes. We can do it. Let's do at least another $3,000 in the next 10 minutes. I think if we wanted to, we could do $7,000 in the next 3 minutes. But whatever it is, remember, we do present an alternative. Now, Davey is here and Miguel is here, and you know the staff of this radio station is extremely talented, and they have experiences that they bring to the airwaves. They have experiences as producers and as folks who have studied various issues and have really wanted to make a difference. I think we are looking good. 1-800-439-5732. Thank you, Gail Kozlowski. Thank you, Antonio Ruiz. We thank you. Lois Tink, we thank you so much. Ortinic. Nick Powers, we thank you. But who's next? Who's next? We've got about 9 minutes. We're working on a $3,000 match. Every dollar that you give us now is doubled. Please pull out.
$5.
$10. I'll take it. I'll
$20.
I'll take it.
$25.
Yeah, $50. Sure.
$100.
Do I hear $1,000? Yes.
Well, if we just get 10 people that are listening to pledge $10 each, that goes a long way.
It sure does.
If we get 10 people to pledge $100 each, and again, you can talk to the people in the phone room and they can let you know what sort of thank you gifts,
anything
ranging from documentaries
available
to what have you. You can, you know, 10 people doing that, that will go a long way. If we get 20 people to pledge $100 each, go online, kpfa.org. It goes a long way. Again, I'm going to keep coming back and I'm going to keep saying this because you're going to see this really come to fruition over the next 6 months, especially as we draw near the election. Folks are playing for keeps. Big moneyed interests are playing for keeps. And they are funding, to the full extent, media outlets that they totally 100% control. And not only are they funding, but they're making sure that they put tight reins on the content. I have friends who work in the commercial sector, and they tell me, Dennis, you know, they're not allowed to talk about the Middle East, not without having somebody from AIPAC and that perspective on the airwaves. Oh. They are not allowed to, you know, you're not allowed to talk about it.
If they
period.
Do it once, they're warned. If they do
you're
it
warned,
twice,
you do it,
they
you're
disappear.
Out of here, right?
Yeah.
You can't, if you're in Southern Cali, yeah. You're not talking about the police brutality without having somebody, a cop who's on staff at one of those stations, sit in the room and start giving you a union perspective on things without you being able to really argue back. We're talking about folks who are now moving the goalpost or up a little, turning up the heat. How are we going to fight back?
All right,
this
I'm
is one way to do it. This
I'm
is one way
heat,
to do it,
Davey. I'm feeling the heat. We've got 8 minutes left to go. We've got a nice amount of money on the web, but it'd be great. We right now through the web, you all have contributed $2,385. I'd like to see that web figure move up to about 5,000. KPFA.org, hit the pledge button, and let's pump up that figure to $5,000. You can, if you prefer the phone, the instant gratification. We've got 7, 8, 9 volunteers in there now. They're ready to take your call. How about it? 1-800-439-5732. We're in a $3,000 match, and maybe you want to match that with $3,000, or maybe you want to give us $10 or $15 or $25. And believe me, we know, I for one know what it means to live paycheck to paycheck. And we know if you, for some people to give $10 or $25, that's like other people giving $100 or $1,000. And believe me, we appreciate it across the spectrum. I thank Davey for making sure that we bring in the $5 people and the $10 people and the $25 people. And of course, we need the extra bucks now too. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Miguel, we are running out of time.
Well, we're running out of time, but I'm going to plead out there, reach out a plea out there to the cannabis industry. The 420 folks out there from the Santa Cruz Mountains to all the way up Sonoma County, Napa County, Solano County, and Mendocino, Humboldt. This is the time to take a stand. Not everything is already secured for the future. There's a lot of cottage industry, small farmers that are getting squeezed out by the corporate state. And it's important here because we're also dealing with so many different fronts. But one of the things that we're devoted here to, and that's to unrig a political system that is working for the corporate state and the super rich against the interest of us, you. That's why we need you now more than ever. There's a revolt we hope is going to happen on coming up here Tuesday, June the 5th, primaries here in California. We need to have a revolt at the ballot box. 1-800-439-5732. Your donation is tax deductible and the phone call is free. 1-800-439-5732. Or you can just dial 1-800-HEY. KPFA, or go to kpfa.org. It's now or never. We need you now more than these last 2-3 weeks that have passed. We need you to contribute.
We're in our final minutes.
This is our
last chance, Hard Knock and Flashpoints, to make sure that we do our work here, that we make a difference. I want to thank Brian Woodson, thank you so much. Leslie Phillips, thank you so much. Joseph Brown, thank you so much. Where are you now? Where are you? Are you in Santa Rosa? Are you in Santa Cruz? Are you in Oakland? Are you in San Francisco? Are you in San Rafael? Are you in Sonoma? Are you in Santa Rosa? Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, won't you please, in these final minutes, whatever you're doing, stop what you're doing and make a rush. Let's have a riot, an uprising, an out of control people's uprising for Free Speech Radio in these final minutes of this show today. Come on, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We're trying to squeak out those last few bucks in these last few minutes. We've got 4 minutes to go. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can do it on the web. If you want, you can get yourself any number, any of the premiums that you heard. I love this idea of voices that change the world, this USB with thousands of incredible programs and voices and incredible stuff. You can get that for a $200 contribution. Get the Doctrine of Discovery documentary, excellent, for a $100 contribution. The 3-DVD set, Capitalism. If you want it with the Gangs for Capitalism, you get them both together for $400. An amazing thing. You can get the Robert Perry 10-hour retrospective for $100. You can get, whatever it is that you need that you've heard is available. And, of course, you can get clothing for any part of your body, branded beautifully here at KPFA.
You know what I've seen, Dennis? I'm watching people online.
Yeah.
And it heartens me to see that there are people giving those small pledges.
Yep.
There are folks that, you know, if we can get 10 more people in the next 3 minutes, that really takes us over the top. 10 more people to pledge, whether it's $10 or $100, that'll go a long way. Go to kpfa.org. Do that right now and join the folks that are already pledging. If you are near a phone, call 1-800-439-5732.
Davey, can we make a $1,000 match in 2 minutes?
Because I think we can.
I think we can.
All right. I think we can. If we can get a $1,000 pledge.
Thank you, Eleanor Tso. We thank you for that contribution. Thank you, Carol Lacey Rivers.
Okay, the clock is on.
Donald Costello. All right.
2 minutes left.
2 minutes.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Can we get a $1,000 match or enough people? You know, 10 people pledging $100 counts as that $1,000 match.
It sure does.
So we have less than a minute and a half.
90 seconds.
Let us do this. Let us call 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-KPFA. We got another pledge online that can count towards that. So KPFA.org. Now, I see all the lines are lit up except two. So we have five lines. We have seven people. So we need two more people to call right now and help us make this $1,000 match. You can contribute towards that match, whether it's $20 a pledge or $200 pledge. We have lots of thank you gifts, but 1-800-439-5732. 1-800. Hey, KPFA.
1 minute, Davey. 1 minute, Miguel. 1 minute. The pressure is on. The number is 1-800-439-5732. We're in a final $1,000 match. It's a beautiful thing, but we're asking you now to stand up and make sure that we secure it, that we do our job here. We've got 30 seconds. You can do it in 30 seconds. The phone number, let me give it to you slowly and memorize it. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Please ring the hell out of those phones in the final remaining seconds of this show. And we do have 30 of them. 1-800-439-5732.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, just in time for asparagus season, Chaz K's fine collage on the horrors of agricultural biotech. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's spring at last in southern New England, and not a moment too soon. No nest of Phoebes over our front door this year, but robins have moved into the pre-owned nest in a bush out front. The nest now has three babies. They spend much of the day with their heads tilted back, their beaks wide open, waiting for a government handout, I guess. Further proof that socialism destroys individual initiative. Or something. Just kidding, of course. And in fact, the local institutions that are genuinely socialist all seem to be working quite well, thank you. These include the municipal water and sewer systems, the municipal trash and leaf collections, the town's two libraries, parks and recreation, and even the public school system. Progressive political scientist Michael Parenti confesses to a soft spot in his heart for some mom-and-pop capitalist enterprises. And I feel the same. In this case, mom-and-pop are Tom and Sherry, with their organic farm 10 miles from here, near where the towns of Bolton, Hebron, and Andover meet, and doubtless quarrel. At Tom and Sherry's, this year's first crop is now in, asparagus. My wife is the family's big asparagus lover, actually, not I. But I will say that this locally grown, freshly picked asparagus is so good you can eat it raw. Lettuce will be late this year, but if you're into asparagus, this is your moment. Speaking of agriculture, now that the academic semester is over, I've been catching up on my listening, and I was struck by one of the inventive and important audio collages by Virtual Renderings, also known as Chaz K. He created this one back in 2013. 5 years later, the piece is just as timely and important as it was then. We have not heard it before on New World Notes, so why not now? It's about the insanity and the dangers and the demonstrable bad effects of genetic monkeying with our food supply. No offense to actual monkeys. Today's installment focuses on two parts of the ag biotech horror show. These are splicing genes from one species into another, and relatedly, the dangers of glyphosate, Monsanto's Roundup, to the human body. So grab a spear of organic asparagus, then munch along with part one of Virtual Renderings Collage, Abominable Ways of Biotech.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
So do you know what genetically modified foods are?
Like tomatoes and things they do, like to make them last longer when they ship them and stuff.
Really? Bettered or improved by species, by collecting the best of and keep going.
But I've heard of them.
Right.
Yeah, I don't really know if it's good or bad.
Did you know that we've been eating these foods for the last 10 years?
No, I haven't known that. Where do they normally sell those kind of foods?
I'm kind of taken back by it. I thought it was just grown in soil, and I didn't know they were modifying my food.
I know.
It's kind of scary.
Well, I know it's been a while. I didn't realize quite that long.
Welcome to the real world.
Americans get sick more often than Europeans and people in other industrialized countries, and they're getting sicker. Since the mid-90s, the number of Americans suffering from at least three chronic illnesses nearly doubled, and America's international ranking for infant mortality and lifespan also plunged. There are many reasons why this is taking place. One may be right in front of you.
They take genes from one species and force it into the DNA of other species. The very process of genetic engineering creates unpredicted side effects.
It does not exist anywhere in nature.
They can put it out on the market without telling the FDA or consumers.
Every single cell within that plant is producing a toxic protein.
BT is designed to break open the stomach of insects and kill them. The EPA got it wrong. It does break open little pores in human cells, and it might cause the same kind of disruption in our guts as it's causing in the insects that it kills.
How did my son get these food allergies? Our food supply is genetically modified. And guess what? The food that my son ate on August 25th, 2009 was raw corn. The corn that almost killed him.
We're continuing to feed our GMO-contaminated food to our children.
Genetic engineering is a false promise whose high price has already been paid by the farmers of this country. Multinationals have grabbed the seed economy, which used to be a farmer's economy, it used to be a women's economy, and now are bringing unreliable, untested seeds to the market, pushing our farmers to suicide. We happen to be sitting in the middle of all the seed industry shops right here. Monsanto this side, Syngenta shops that side, the next lane is all selling seeds of suicide.
Now you've got companies that are putting foreign genes into animals and fish that are changing the crops of the world fundamentally at the genetic level and polluting the planet with its genetic pollution. And once again, only a few scientists, corporations, and government regulators are making the decision. There's no democratic decision making. These technologies our legislation. They're going to affect our lives more than any law passed by any legislature around the world.
I'm ready for a dietary change. But how in the world do I know who to trust? Oh, when everybody's making contradictory claims, complicating it all so much. So I listen to the source that the big food companies endorse. Then of course I'm in the best of hands. But if there's something fishy with the things we see at the Dietitian's Academy, we should question if their opinions are independent. What if health authorities only recommended what the big food companies said they cared? Then if we put them to the test, we'd find they've been influenced just like the rest. It's a conflict of interest.
What does that mean?
It means buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy, because Kansas is going bye-bye.
The saddest thing for me is that every failure from the perspective of a poor peasant and a small farmer in this country is not a failure from the perspective of these companies. I, in fact, traveled with one of them about two decades ago. And they said to us, it doesn't matter if the crops don't do well, it's all right, they'll come back for more of our seeds. The farmer gets wiped out, the land gets wiped out, the company's markets grow. And that, I think, is the real tragedy of genetic engineering, that the failure of agriculture is a market success for the corporation.
It's very important to think that this, once this biological contamination is very different than chemical contamination. If you have an oil spill, it will dilute over time. Even a chemical spill will dilute over time. This is not chemical pollution, this is about living pollution. Biological pollution. Once these fish are released into a bay or a river, you can't recall them. No scientist can say, come back, please. You can't put a net and get them. It's over. It's over. And in the United States, we have yet to have our first law. We don't have a single law which regulates this kind of biological pollution. It is completely unregulated, even though its effects will be catastrophic and you will not be able to remedy those. You'll not be able to recall this.
To avoid bad mouthing of your products, just pay the right people's bills. Take a hint from the dairy industry, convince so many they need pasteurized animal milk. When you're teaching dietitians, artificial sweeteners and fluoride are safe for kids. Well, now you've made it obvious that you've been influenced. 'Cause when soda and junk food companies are publicly giving you your funds, now to say anything in defense of them is insulting my intelligence. 'Cause it seems a bit naive if you really can't believe, after taking their money, they'd ever say those products were unhealthy. Are they really looking out for them instead of you? What would you do? What if health authorities only recommended what the big food companies said they cared? Test, we find they've been influenced.
this one gene, one protein, one trait caricature of how genetics works. That's the whole foundation of the biotechnology industry, is a complete misrepresentation of everything we know about how genetics in complex organisms actually works. Biotechnologists think genes are genes. It doesn't matter where you stick them, and they'll just function the way they normally do. Any geneticist who thinks about that should know better. Genes don't function alone. They function within the context of the entire genome. Nature acts on the entire genome because after fertilization, there are whole sets of genes turned on and off in the proper sequence so that you get the development of a complete organism. So that whole orchestration is an integrated genome that acts as a complete entity. To take a gene out of a fish and stick it into a plant means the fish gene suddenly wakes up and goes, where the hell am I? Who are all these other genes around me? Because you've altered the context within which that gene is found. It would be like taking Bono out of U2 and putting him into the New York Philharmonic Orchestra and say, okay, folks, play music. Well, you get noise of some sort, but nobody can anticipate what the sum total of that activity will be. It's just a mistake to think that genes act as if their traits are expressed regardless of where they exist.
The goal of Monsanto was to replace all natural seed, to have all global agriculture completely driven by genetically modified seed, and to create a market for the chemicals associated with those genetically modified seed. There was no sense of nature. There was discussion of how to eliminate natural seed.
When I get in discussions with people, they say, well, the government reviewed them. The governments approved them. There were mountains of studies done. They couldn't have gotten it that wrong. And if it was so bad, somebody would speak up about it. But in reality, the few people that have spoken up about it have paid a high personal and professional price for it.
Because of the direct investments of these companies in our universities, new professors know very well that if you expect to get tenure, don't do any negative research on GMO.
Has got corporate money invested to ensure they monopolize, making recommendations so blatantly on behalf of sponsoring industry. Got respect for dietitians who think for themselves, but your organization doing something else. Like the inmates running the asylum, what if hell?
Now, Roundup was originally patented as an herbicide by the company called Monsanto, and they own most of the patents for GMOs as well. And having studied Monsanto for a number of years, I can say that in their quieter, more reflective moments, they ask themselves, what would Darth Vader do? Because what they've come up with is a way of pretending that they're beneficial and then insinuating themselves into the food industry, the agriculture industry, and now it turns out that what they have is very, very dangerous. And among those very dangerous things is glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup. And it was the subject of a very comprehensive evaluation, an article co-written by Dr. Seneff, and it's called this is going to be more science than you're ready for, the name here. Mm. Glyphosate suppression of cytochrome P450 enzymes and amino acid biosynthesis by the gut microbiome, pathways to modern disease. Now, I looked at this paper, and it all reads like that. Very, very difficult to understand. But what jumped out at me in the abstract, I'm going to read it to you. The consequences of glyphosate and all the things that it can go wrong are most of the diseases and conditions associated with a Western diet, which include gastrointestinal problems, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, depression, autism, infertility, cancer, and Alzheimer's disease.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
Dysbiosis.
Dysbiosis, what does that mean?
The gut bacteria are not properly balanced, and there's like inflammation, and there's leaky gut. And
technical term, messed
yeah,
up.
Yeah, okay. And right. They have trouble eating lots of different things. They right. end up with gluten intolerance. Lots of the autistic kids are on gluten-free diet. You know, you can see they've got problems in the gut. Number one. And number two is sulfur. There's a...
sulfur.
Yeah, there's a clear problem with sulfur metabolites. Now, it turns out sulfur is incredibly important to the body, and there's very little talked about it. Actually, even in nutrition books, it's hardly mentioned. It doesn't have a minimum daily requirement. It's considered to be plentiful, and therefore we should never worry about a deficiency. And I believe this is a key problem in our nutritional space, that we have become blind to sulfur. And I think that, in fact, sulfur deficiency, and more specifically sulfate deficiency, and I'll get to that in a moment, is a key factor in all the modern problems that we're having. And it's something that is not on anybody's radar screen.
So first of all, the gut bacteria is involved with both the immune system and the digestive system. So when it's messed up, it can create a whole series of problems.
There's these two things, the gut bacteria. So the gut bacteria have the shikimate pathway. The shikimate pathway produces aromatic amino acids, and these are essential amino acids. We actually get them from our diet or from our gut bacteria.
So there's a bunch of amino acids that we have to get from outside. They're called essential. Now, is aromatic a subset of those?
Yes.
All right.
And we can't make them. Our chemistry doesn't allow us to make them, so if we don't get them from our diet. What happens then is that the gut bacteria being hit with glyphosate, they can't make these amino acids because of this shikimate pathway getting disrupted. And instead, they make other stuff because the pathway gets deflected into these other things. Mm-hmm. And the other things that they make are not good. There's, for example, picresol, which is made by C. difficile. C. difficile is a runaway pathogen that's been causing lots and lots of trouble in hospitals lately.
Oh, yeah,
Clostridium
yeah.
difficile.
Yeah.
And it produces this thing called picresol, which is a toxic phenol. And so there's a lot of talk about toxic phenols being produced by the gut bacteria, and those things are toxic. They can disrupt your DNA. They can cause problems with your fats in your cell membranes. I mean, they basically are kind of a wrecking ball.
So we have wrecking balls being produced in our own gut bacteria
right.
because the shikimate pathway is no longer being able to function, so it's producing...
It's going to there instead.
It's saying,
like
okay, we're going to produce these really horrible things.
Right. So that's one of them,
okay.
yeah.
All right.
And then there's a certain bacteria that can break down glyphosate, which is terrific. They can get rid of it. They're a really super deal. However, what they make is ammonia.
Great. Higher than the general population?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is it much higher?
Yes, well, I think so. And also in Alzheimer's. So both of them have
So Alzheimer's ammonia. And autistic kids have high levels of ammonia in the blood.
Yeah.
And we know that ammonia causes, what is it in the brain?
Encephalopathy, yeah.
Encephalitis. Yes,
it actually causes a very interesting, which I've written a paper about this, actually, a very interesting reaction in the brain. A severe case, you can have like a high fever, you can get seizures, you can get coma. But I think in the case of autism, there's a low-grade version of this problem going on chronically.
So we talked about the fact that glyphosate knocks off the shikimic pathway. And now what else are you going to tell me?
Yeah, so it does this by disrupting that pathway, and then it also interferes with these CYP enzymes through a totally different mechanism. It gets into the cells, and in the liver, has tons of these enzymes. One of the things these enzymes do is detoxify toxins. So it disrupts the enzymes that detoxify the other toxins that we're exposed to, which is really that's meta, you know?
That is. So in other words, there's this whole troop of people, of enzymes that go around and say, okay, clear it out, you've had stuff with this disease this chemical or that chemical. You have these overgrowth of bacteria. So it all goes into the primary detoxifier, the liver.
Yes.
And then the whole troops that are out there cleaning up, they become disabled.
Disabled.
How bad? I mean, this cytochrome.
Cytochrome P450. P40. You can call it CYP, C-Y-P.
C-Y-P.
Yeah.
So C-Y-P is really important to make these troops do the detoxification.
That's right.
And so... How does it, so you're saying that glyphosate not only blocks the shikimic pathway, but another pathway altogether?
Yeah, it interferes actually with the actual molecule, all the different molecules that are CYP enzymes. And these enzymes are really interesting. They have huge roles in the body. They activate vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot to do with cholesterol homeostasis. And so I think that a lot of the problems people are having with cholesterol could be tied to this. And making the bile acids that will digest the fats.
Digest the fats, is that obesity?
Yeah, well, that's certainly part of that problem,
okay,
yeah.
Right.
And then the sex hormones, all the stuff that's involved with the sex hormones, aromatase is an enzyme that converts testosterone into estrogen. And one of the things that's associated with autism is aromatase deficiency, and glyphosate has been shown specifically to block aromatase. So that's a specific example. Some of the other ones I'm generalizing from the evidence, because there's several papers that talk about glyphosate disrupting various enzymes, and so you can infer that it would, and the mechanism that it uses is general to all of them.
Okay.
So you can infer that wherever it gets close to one of them, it's going to cause problems. And there's tons of them in the liver, and the glyphosate goes straight to the liver through the hepatic port of vein. So you kind of put two and two together and get five of that.
Why are the issues with glyphosate relevant to the discussion about genetically modified crops?
Glyphosate is the chemical name for that compound that mm-hmm. is attributed for herbicidal action. Mm-hmm. The Roundup is a formulated product that includes other components besides just the glyphosate chemistry in order to increase its penetration into plant cells. Mm-hmm. Or its activity as an herbicide. When you have a genetically engineered crop that's resistant to glyphosate, it not only permits the wider use of the glyphosate, the extended exposure to it, but it also permits then the application of glyphosate directly on that crop, which many times we're consuming.
We've heard the first half of Virtual Renderings' Abominable Ways of Biotech, including the voices of Vandana Shiva, Andrew Kimbrell, Davis Suzuki, Dr. Stephanie Seneff, and others. I myself am Dr. Kenneth Doust. From Darkest, Connecticut, I thank you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Please remember, illegitimi non carborundum, an injury to one is an injury to all, war is not healthy for children and other living things. And for part two of the biotech collage, please come back again next week. Peace.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear was originally aired in April of 2015. Currently, the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have 2,995 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation into 9/11. And there are currently 9/11 family members suing Saudi Arabia under the JASTA Act, which came out as a result of the 28 pages. I'll be talking more about the Saudis and 9/11 on a future broadcast. So here's today's show. There are now 2,349 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation into the events of 9/11. And in addition to the 2,349 architects and engineers that have signed this petition demanding a new investigation, there are currently 20,204 regular folks who are not architects and engineers who have also signed the petition. So if you aren't one of those, you might want to go to that website and do it right now, ae911truth.org. And their founder, architect Richard Gage, is currently on a multi-country tour of Europe, including Iceland. As I reported on a previous show, YouTube, which has been owned by Google since 2007, took down a video posted by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth that starred Ed Asner, 9/11 victims, family members, scientists, and first responders, all challenging the official account of 9/11 and all demanding a real investigation. It had over 1 million views before it was taken down. And the video is called Solving the Mystery of World Trade Center 7 with Ed Asner. For some reason, somebody doesn't want you to see or hear or know what's in this video. The Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth complained to YouTube when this happened, and my understanding is that it was put back up on YouTube. But the fact that it was taken down, censored, if you will, makes me want to watch it and share it with all of you. What is it that they don't want us to see, hear, know? So you can listen to the video and see what you think. So here it is, Solving the Mystery of World Trade Center Building 7 with Ed Asner.
Throughout the ages, architects and engineers have designed and built the great structures that have made our world and withstood the test of time. Hi, I'm Ed Asner. Welcome to Architects and Engineers. Let's look now at modern steel frame buildings. This is the Empire State Building, a marvel of modern architecture. It was built to last. Architects and engineers of today use computers to design and engineer buildings that will endure the forces of nature, such as earthquakes, fires, and hurricanes. This modern skyscraper was also built to last. We've seen buildings completely destroyed like this before, but only when done intentionally. Danny Jowenko is the expert on this in Europe. What did he say?
This is controlled demolition.
Zeker weten.
Zeker weten. Er is nagesprongen. Dit is in opdracht gebeurd. Dit heeft een team gedaan van experts.
Let's compare. Explosives are used to demolish buildings like this in just seconds. Okay, so it's a controlled demolition. What's the problem with that? Well, it happened on the afternoon of 9/11 at the World Trade Center. Let's just think about this. Controlled demolitions cannot be engineered and rigged in a day. It takes months. And therefore, this event must have been planned in advance.
You hear that?
Keep your eye on that building. It'll be coming down.
The building is about to blow up. Move it back. We are walking back. There's a building about to blow up.
Did they actually use the word brought down? And who was it that was telling you this?
In the fire department. And they did use the word, we're going to have to bring it down.
And these people heard explosions.
We heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. It looked like there was a shockwave ripping through the building, and the windows all busted out. About a second later, the bottom floor caved out. The building followed after that.
He takes his hand off, and you hear 3, 2, 1, and it was boom, 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 boom.
And these reporters recognized it as a controlled demolition.
And I turned in time to see what looked like a skyscraper implosion. It looked like it had been done by a demolition crew. The whole thing just collapsing down on itself.
For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
It was almost as if it were a planned implosion. It just pancaked.
So what's the problem if this was a planned demolition? Well, we are told by government agencies that this building came down as a result of normal office fires. The National Institute of Standards and Technology produced their final report in 2008.
World Trade Center 7 collapsed because of fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosives or from fuel oil fires.
But what do you think brought down the building?
And what caught my eye is more than 1,300 architects and engineers examine the evidence about Building 7's collapse and disagree with the official report issued by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I certainly am much more open-minded about it than I was, and it is because of the involvement of the 9/11 families and all these engineers and architects.
You are about to hear from architect of 23 years, Richard Gage, AIA, member of the American Institute of Architects and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Now there are more than 1,500 architects and engineers who say that it could not have been brought down by office fires. They are backed by 9/11 family members. We're calling for an independent, unbiased investigation.
I'm Richard Gage. Fires have never before caused the collapse of any skyscraper, even though there are numerous examples of much hotter, larger, and longer-lasting fires in these buildings. And in the case of Building 7, the fire that NIST said started the collapse had actually burned out over an hour before. It could not have caused the collapse, as NIST claims. Yet this 47-story, modern steel-frame skyscraper, which was not hit by an airplane, collapses mostly into its own footprint like a house of cards, as fast as a bowling ball falling off the side of the building, in just under 7 seconds. Listen to the experts.
Building number 7 descended in free fall for the first 100 feet, which means that there was absolutely no resistance to the descent whatsoever.
NIST has admitted it went into free fall for 8 stories. And going from motionless to free fall instantly, that's a bothersome part of the puzzle because NIST never explained it.
We've got a building that came down in its own footprint, so all of the columns really needed to be severed at the same time in order for that structure to fall the way that we saw.
The symmetry is the smoking gun.
The whole building completely comes down in one continuous motion. There couldn't have been any structural resistance.
According to NIST, the failure occurred at column 79 on level 12. They're talking about a single columnar collapse or failure that resulted in a total collapse of the building.
It is possible that you could have a local failure as a result of a connection failing.
But the likelihood of that failure dragging the entire building in such a fashion that all the columns would fail at the same time is an impossibility.
Impossibility?
Yes.
What I saw, it was a classic implosion. The center of the core, the penthouse area, starts to move first, and then the building follows along with it.
I'd like to know why NIST excluded the document from FEMA in Appendix C that documented the evidence of melting steel. Why is this forensic evidence not being included in the report?
In an office fire, you cannot generate enough heat to melt steel. And yet we have evidence of molten iron. R.J. Lee Company, USGS, and Dr. Stephen Jones's work, all three separately found these microspheres.
In the dust, we found what we characterize as unreacted thermitic material in the shape of some very tiny red-gray chips, which have different properties, and in the reaction they produce molten iron, which is the prime indication of a thermitic reaction. And such a reaction can be used to destroy steel structures. What we have found is a modern version of thermite, which we call nanothermite.
There were these iron microspheres present in all of the dust samples that needed to have been formed in extremely high temperatures.
I've independently seen thermitic activity within two separate independent samples of World Trade Center dust. My contention, based on finding thermite residue in the dust, is that it happened before. It didn't happen after in the fires that ensued in the rubble pile afterwards. All the characteristics of the microspheres tell me that thermite was involved in melting those steel beams.
So thermite, if it was present at the World Trade Center and created this molten metal that so many witnesses and photographic evidence shows, would also explain the fact that the fires could not be put out at Ground Zero.
The only thing that is consistent with all of the evidence that we have that could cause such a thing is the use of thermite to cut through the steel.
You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel. Oh. Molten steel running down the channel rails. Like you're in a foundry.
Yeah. Like lava.
Like lava.
From a volcano.
Well, the manual gets into thermite, and if it says if you have melted steel or concrete, which we had on 9/11, we should test for it.
It's this fused element of steel, molten steel and concrete and all of these things all fused by the heat into one single element.
We're asking for an investigation that follows national standards. There's no excuse to not test for this. If terrorists use explosives in 93, why didn't we test for them? If all these witnesses heard explosions, why aren't we testing for them?
NIST concedes that they found no evidence for explosives. So then we asked them, well, did you look? And they said, no, we did not look for explosives or residues of explosives.
So the preconceived notion of NIST is that there's no evidence for explosives, and so there's no point in looking. That is the most unscientific thing that you can possibly think of, not to look because you don't expect to find evidence, and in fact the evidence is overwhelming. They state these conclusions for which there's virtually no evidence, and then they ignore conclusions that can be drawn from the evidence.
The Freedom of Information Act request to NIST was denied with the claim that releasing this data might jeopardize public safety. How could it possibly jeopardize public safety?
The destruction of evidence was a criminal act in itself. It was already being carted away and destroyed when the FEMA investigators got there about a month after September 11th.
You can't do science when you are deprived of the evidence and when your hypothesis is the least valid instead of the most likely. When the most likely hypothesis in the case of Building 7 wasn't even mentioned. This is not science.
The scientific forensic evidence ignored by NIST, but carefully reviewed by teams of technical professionals, corroborates the hypothesis of explosive controlled demolition. We've traveled to 21 foreign countries and 32 American cities, bringing this evidence to the attention of the public. And we're backed by 9/11 family members and other concerned citizens who are calling for an independent, unbiased investigation.
I'm a family member trying to find out the answers to the murder of 3,000 plus people. The bottom line is that it needs to be investigated properly.
Please look at architects and engineers. People all around the world, scientists all around the world, are questioning this. And there's some deep, deep explaining to do.
It took some kind of consciousness raising on my part before I was willing to look at the possibilities. And really, you need to go where the evidence leads.
As an engineer, I have 3 degrees in engineering. I signed that petition for architects and engineers for 9/11 truth some time ago because the American people absolutely need the truth of 9/11.
Look at the evidence. In fact, I'll say this very categorically. Any reasonable person who looks at the evidence that's been brought forward has got to come away with the feeling that something has to be done, a real investigation has to be put forward.
We will never heal. This country will never, ever, ever forget that day. We have to demand a new investigation. I want justice here.
The country owns this. We were all victims. You all should want answers. It's not just ours, not just mine. We all lost something that day.
It's distressing for everyone to come to terms with this evidence, but we must pursue the truth wherever it leads. Look at the evidence and decide for yourself.
And again, that was the YouTube video, Solving the Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7 with Ed Asner, that was recently removed from YouTube and then reposted after the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth complained. Some of the media voices you heard in the video were Geraldo Rivera and Dan Rather. And some of the scientists were Lynn Margulis, the late wife of Carl Sagan, the late NASA scientist Bob Bowman, Tony Zambodi, who spoke here at our conference on World Trade Center 7 a few years ago, and high school physics teacher David Chandler, and family member Bob McElvain, who lost his son in the towers. And of course, the video of this is much more powerful than the audio, so I encourage you to check it out at YouTube. And again, it's Solving the Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7 with Ed Asner. You know, occasionally some family and friends will say to me, why are you still talking about 9/11? That was almost 14 years ago. And my answer is that as long as 9/11 is being used to justify the global war on terror and used to take away our civil liberties under the Patriot Act, and as long as we're under continuity of government, or COG, which we have been since 9/11, and as long as the bogus global war on terror is used to destroy country after country in the Middle East and kill millions of innocent people, and as long as the government and media cover it up, I'm going to talk about it. As many of you know, there are mountains of evidence that 9/11 was a false flag event, planned and orchestrated by the neocons, with some major and minor roles played by other countries and their intelligence agencies, and blamed on Al-Qaeda and the Muslims. There's also ample evidence that most, if not all, of the alleged terrorist attacks in the U.S. since 9/11 have serious FBI involvement in setting people up and then catching them. And there's ample evidence that Al-Qaeda and ISIS and other terrorist groups were created by the CIA with the help of their friends in the Middle East and elsewhere. It's a brilliant plan if you want to destabilize a country. And most people believe the propaganda pumped out by the corporate media and a lot of the alternative media, so they get away with it. To illustrate this point, here's a short clip from the Max Keiser Report, where Max is interviewing Robert Steele, a former U.S. Marine, CIA officer, co-creator of the Marine Corps Intelligence Service, and author of the Open Source Everything Manifesto, Transparency, Truth, and Trust. And here it is.
There are several terror events in Europe by Europeans recently. Now, each one of the bad guys was already known to security services. A good example being here in the UK, they had somebody who was on MI5's radar. He went off to join ISIS, and he became the jihadi John. So your thoughts, is this because we have too much data or too many people on the terror watch list? There's not enough real intelligence. What's going on here?
Well, Max, this may be too much for you guys, but let me give you the bottom line as I see it. Most terrorists are false flag terrorists or are created by our own security services. Now, I have no direct access in England, but I will tell you that here in the United States, every single terrorist incident we have had has been a false flag or has been an informant pushed on by the FBI. In fact, we now have citizens taking out restraining orders against FBI informants that are trying to incite terrorism. We've become a lunatic asylum. As far as Jihadi John, the best guess that I can give you is that this is funded by Saudi Arabia, trained by CIA. This destruction of ancient artifacts and so on, that's a covert action influence operation. That's not something they would normally do. This is, in one word, largely theater.
The global 9/11 truth movement has grown so large and has reached so many people that perhaps the perpetrators are getting nervous. The recent hype made about declassifying the 28 redacted pages of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11 is part of a plan, I believe, to divert the attention to the Saudis and away from others more deeply involved. This is what a recent article posted on the website globalresearch.ca called Saudi Arabia's Alleged Involvement in the 9/11 Attacks, a Red Herring Propaganda Ploy, has to say about it. The 9/11 narrative in the mainstream media has taken on a new slant. The FBI is now accused of whitewashing Saudi involvement in the 9/11 attacks. The alleged Saudi involvement in supporting Osama bin Laden, not to mention the classified 28 pages of the 9/11 Joint Congressional Inquiry pertaining to the insidious role of Saudi Arabia in supporting the hijackers, is part of a propaganda ploy. When the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11 was released in December 2002, it was met with considerable skepticism. That skepticism grew for a period of time, but then was reduced to speculation about what was contained in the 28 pages that had been redacted by the Bush White House. Various U.S. government leaders have since suggested that the missing 28 pages point to Saudi Arabia's complicity in the 9/11 crimes. However, such musings fail to discuss other important issues, like the links between the Saudi regime and the Western deep state. Discussion of the missing 28 pages also omits mention of the highly suspicious nature of the inquiry's investigation and its leaders. The key figure behind this new wave of propaganda is former Senator Bob Graham, who led the joint inquiry of the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees together with Representative Porter Goss, a career CIA official who was subsequently appointed Director of National Intelligence by the Bush administration. Graham coordinated the drafting and editing of the report, including the 28 classified pages on Saudi Arabia. While Graham is now heralded by the mainstream media as a 9/11 truther, the evidence suggests that immediately in the wake of 9/11. He was involved, together with Porter Goss, in a cover-up on behalf of Bush Cheney. According to Kevin Ryan, in the months following 9/11, both Goss and Graham rejected calls for an investigation. Both the joint inquiry led by Graham and the 9/11 Commission were part of a big lie. And now Bob Graham and 9/11 Commission Chairman Thomas Keene are accusing the FBI of camouflage and the Saudis of collusion in the 9/11 attacks, while failing to acknowledge cover-up and complicity at the highest levels of the U.S. government. And because Bob Graham accuses the FBI and the federal government, the 9/11 Truth Movement applauds without realizing that these accusations directed against the FBI are framed with a view to sustaining the mainstream 9/11 narrative. What is at stake is a desperate ploy to uphold the legend that Muslims were behind 9/11 and that Saudi Arabia was behind the terrorists, giving them money, with the FBI involved in a cover-up, George W. Bush protecting his Saudi cronies because the Bushes and the Bin Ladens were intimate friends. Former Senator Graham smells a rat, and that rat is the FBI and complicit government agencies. But who is the rat? The FBI or Senator Bob Graham, who is visibly involved in a cover-up on behalf of U.S. intelligence? He accuses U.S. government agencies of negligence, which serves to arouse protest against the FBI by many 9/11 truthers. Graham's staged accusations thereby serve to distract the American public's attention from the real evidence, amply documented that the World Trade Center towers were brought down through controlled demolition and that Islamic terrorists were not behind the 9/11 attacks. The issue of Saudi financial support of al-Qaeda is not only known and documented since the heyday of the Soviet-Afghan war, it is irrelevant to establishing who was behind the terror attacks. Moreover, the contents of the 28 classified pages are known. Calling for the official release and publication of the 28 classified pages in the joint inquiry report pertaining to Saudi Arabia is an obvious red herring. The objective is to confuse matters, create divisions within the 9/11 truth movement, and ultimately dispel the fact that the 9/11 attacks were a carefully organized false flag event, which has been used to declare war on Afghanistan as well as usher in sweeping anti-terrorist legislation. Both the congressional inquiry as well as the 9/11 Commission report are flawed. Their objective was to sustain the official narrative that America was under attack on September 11, 2001, and Graham's role in liaison with the CIA is damage control with a view to protecting those who were behind the demolition of the World Trade Center towers as well as sustaining the al-Qaeda legend, which constitutes the cornerstone of U.S. military doctrine under the so-called global war on terrorism. Without 9/11 and the global war on terrorism, the warmongers in high office would not have a leg to stand on. In turn, 9/11 truth is an encroachment which undermines war propaganda and the U.S.-led campaign of Islamophobia, which is sweeping the Western world. This has served to precipitate segments of the 9/11 truth movement into an erroneous and contradictory discourse. On the part of the U.S. government and its intelligence apparatus, the objective is ultimately to build a narrative which will weaken the 9/11 truth movement. The purpose of the new propaganda ploy is ultimately to sustain the legend that Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks and that Saudi Arabia relentlessly supported al-Qaeda, namely that Saudi Arabia acted as a state sponsor of terrorism. There is, however, an obvious hiccup in this reasoning. If the Saudis were indeed the state sponsors of 9/11, why on earth did the U.S. and the Atlantic Alliance, under the doctrine of collective security, choose to wage a just war of retribution against Afghanistan? Did they get their countries mixed up? So, my 9/11 Truth colleagues, don't be fooled by the 28 redacted pages ploy. I did a show 3 or 4 months ago on Bob Graham and Porter Goss and their backgrounds and inconsistencies in relation to this new push for the 28 redacted pages. You can hear that show by going to radioforall.net. And once on the site, search under Cheryl with a C and the show should pop up. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. We are absolutely delighted, Ken, to have with us from Puerto Rico, Giovanni Roberto is a Puerto Rican social justice activist and organizer with the Center for Political, Educational, and Cultural Development based in Cagua, a former student leader of the militant 2010-2011 mobilization and strikes at the University of Puerto Rico, and is an organizer with Centro de Apoyo Mutua. I'm getting there. The Center of Mutual Support. He will be discussing how its projects and others are creating alternative solutions to meet the basic subsistence needs of the Puerto Rican people and the sustainability of the island of Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. And, of course, the Junta, the Fiscal Control Board. Who else do we have in studio?
We have David Galaza, who is a Puerto Rican labor and community activist who has worked with many, many, many of the frontline organizations in Puerto Rico, including Comedores Sociales and Casa Pueblo de Ajuntas.
Ajuntas, right? Okay, we got it. Giovanni, let's begin. Talk about the conditions at this juncture on the island.
You might know the hurricane destroyed our infrastructure. 7 months after the hurricane, a lot of people, close to the 30% of the population, still don't have electrical lights, including myself. Besides that, I think that the main problem now is that our government and the junta, they are using what happened to implement a neoliberal program that is a dream for most of the capitalists. For the last two decades, they were trying to pass some of the laws that now they are passing. For example, they passed a law to privatize the public sector of education, implementing the charter school in Puerto Rico, which Puerto Rican teachers were able to defeat two times before. In 2008, a general strike of teachers for 10 days achieved to stop the charter school. So this is the worst hurricane after a natural disaster. The worst part is the social disasters that come with it. They are also trying to privatize the electrical system of Puerto Rico. Close to these days, they were discussing to transform the labor law, trying to eliminate a lot of human rights that laborers have there. So the situation is bad for the people because of the basic needs that have been transformed, but also what we expect is things to get worse in the next year. So part of our work here is to let people know what is happening and also to get support from people here in New York, not only Puerto Ricans, but other people like you, you know, allies that we have here, because we're going to need all the support possible the next year.
And David, please join in the discussion.
It's going to get much worse because of this privatization scheme. They're planning to shut down some close to 300 public schools on top of several hundred that they've already closed. They're going to make, in effect, Puerto Rico a right-to-work state, eliminate all kinds of labor laws, reduce the minimum wage, basically enact all the austerity acts and legislation, like Giovanni said, that they haven't been able to do. They're using this as the disaster capitalism to enact a lot of these legislation. We've seen probably the biggest exodus so far of people leaving the island within the last 7 months. It's only going to get worse because if you can't put a roof over your head and food on the table, you're going to look to the next best thing, which is to move to the States or some other place where you can sustain your family. So Giovanni is here with that purpose in mind, to just not only talk about his program, but also talk about the things that we need to start looking at as a diaspora, but more importantly, because of all the intersections, you know, that Puerto Rico is, you know, we're workers, we're people of color from the diaspora, we're Caribbean people, just have so much in common with so many workers and people here in the States. And we want to lift, we're going to continue to elevate the situation in Puerto Rico, because we know that if allowed to our own devices, people will just forget about Puerto Rico. And it's been 7 months. And like Giovanni said, there's still tens of thousands of people without energy. The water is still contaminated. They still have to heat up the water. And we're only 2 months away from hurricane season. So we know we're in a tough position.
Well, more important, what is happening is that is hope in the middle of this situation. There's hope in chaos, too. What we're trying to keep the morale up and to try to push those projects and institutions that can maintain the hope. And that's part of our work with the Mutual Aid Centers, to actually have a space where people can go, can resolve some of their needs, but also learn how to organize our people.
Tell us more about the mutual aid, because that does seem to be a form of hope and a new area that we haven't discussed before. What do you mean by mutual aid, and how did you get to the point to provide this kind of aid?
Also, you're a socialist. I'm interested in the politics as well behind that, that builds towards, as we call this to begin with, que viva Puerto Rico libre, and what that means in terms of the work that you're doing.
Yeah, we consider what we do a political act, a radical act. Serving food, it might look like a charity thing, but for us it's not. We are inspired in what the Black Panthers did and what the Yonders did here in the United States during the 60s and 70s, implementing surviving programs, especially the breakfast program and the health programs. Solidarity could be a strong way of organizing people in the middle of a situation in which a lot of people are just surviving or thinking about themselves. We had this program, Comedores Sociales. In English, we use community kitchen. We started in 2013. For our surprise, the program was an immediate success. It responded in a way to what people needed, not only food, but people need a hope, a way of organizing with other people. And I think after the hurricane, it was more easy for us to start a mutual aid center because it was already our value. We were operating in the value of mutual aid. For us, for example, it's not a matter of giving food. It's a matter of asking people to do something for the food, because we don't give free food. We ask people to do something. In our perspective, that's part of a decolonization perspective. We need people to be active in change, to be part of the organization of their needs. For that, we need to ask to people to do something. Bring some money if you have, but if you don't have money, come and work with us. Come clean the dishes. Help us to cook. In that way, we integrate people that are in need in a political perspective to be part of change in a different way. We are not asking people to be independentists, even though I strongly believe that we're building independentism. We're building free nation by building the programs that help people to understand that our freedom is tied to our living conditions. Not only protesting is important in this time, it's proposing alternatives and building those alternatives that can actually push our reality forward.
And I understand there are 8 other locations that have sprung up with your group as an inspiration that are providing that kind of service and other services. Can you talk a bit about that?
We started in Caguas 8 days after Maria, especially because we were doing the work before. We had a meeting like a week after we started in Caguas, a meeting with other activists in Puerto Rico. And it was difficult to actually be successful convocating a meeting without communication. But we did. And during that meeting, we proposed to some activists in Puerto Rico to actually start mutual aid centers. A week after that, some of the mutual aid centers that already exist, that still exist to this day, started. So we have like 5 mutual aids in the countryside of the Puerto Rico, in the west side. And there's other 5 at mutual aid in the east side of Puerto Rico. So now we are in the middle of a situation in which we have gained some force, but at the same time we need to implement a network between all of these spaces. If we want to be visible in a national politics and we be visible for people, we need a network to connect with. Not only a national network there in Puerto Rico, but also connection with the people in the U.S. We were able to start these programs because of the support of a lot of people in the States. Our diaspora, our Puerto Ricans here in the U.S., were really very active sending stuff or sending money or even sending letters to us. So it's important to recognize here that I have the opportunity.
Politically, how do the people of Puerto Rico, how do your organizational folks really understand the nature of the catastrophic forces that are at play, which would seem to be trying to turn Puerto Rico not only into a land of privatization, work-wise, but perhaps an elite bedroom community or vacation community of the Caribbean and very little else.
We are controlled by financial capitalists. Yesterday, I was talking with a Puerto Rican friend here. We're talking about Hawaii and how Puerto Rico might be a Hawaii in 20 years, and we don't fight enough during these years.
We're facing two forces here, which is, you know, the hurricane, but even before that, the economic and colonial force. A lot of folks here have described what would happen after Maria as Maria sort of like blowing the lid or the veil of over 500 years of colonialism in Puerto Rico. When, for instance, Julia Kelleher, which is the consultant or the secretary of education now in Puerto Rico, decides to privatize public schools and make them charters and close down all these schools and fire teachers. The parents obviously get it, and the teachers get it, and the students get it. They're attacking public education. So there are a lot of consultants being brought into Puerto Rico. There's no money in Puerto Rico, supposedly, but they're bringing in consultants that are not Puerto Rican from the States, and they're paying them hundreds and thousands of dollars in salaries. Even the PREPA guy, the guy who just got named to the energy company, is also being brought in for several hundred thousand dollars. The guy who's going to be doing tourism in Puerto Rico, another American, several hundred thousand dollars. Natalie Jaresco, who is the head of the junta, the director, gets paid $650,000.
That's the head of the fiscal control board.
And we're not talking about the millions of dollars that consultants that work for the junta are getting. All kinds of lawyers and consultants and PR people. They're renting space at 26 Federal Plaza, where we just came from. We had the demonstration there against the junta. It's obscene the kinds of monies that they seem to have for people that are supposedly there to help the crisis in Puerto Rico. And so people get that. Even though still talking about corporate media in Puerto Rico that has does a very good job of distracting folks from what really matters and does a good job of not giving people enough information about what's really going on. People are wise. Perhaps in the beginning, they might have thought because of the corruption in politics that maybe it was okay to bring a junta in. And correct me if I'm wrong. But now people are saying, hell no, we know this junta is here to destroy us. And more people are getting. But the thing is, it's a 1-2 punch. We got hit, with the junta, then we got hit with Maria. And that's becoming so important now more than ever for us, not just the Boricuas in the diaspora to come together, but for people of goodwill across this country who are involved in Black Lives Matter, who are involved with the Me Too movement, who are involved with immigration to come together because we're facing, in many instances, a lot of the same enemies. And whether it's being in Flint, Michigan or New Orleans, we're facing a lot of the same corporations and government bureaucracies that have made it a living hell for communities of color, especially in places like Flint and in places like New Orleans.
And Giovanni, do you see forming an alliance? Has there been participation on the part of the working class, the trabajadores, in the kind of efforts that you're working on to build these food and these kind of self-help, self-determination centers?
Yeah, after the hurricane, I think we were all involved in some way in the so-called rebuilding of Puerto Rico, especially, for example, the Federation of Teachers. We're really involved acting in communities and helping people in communities. I know that some unions build their own operational centers, also bring food to people and medical care to Puerto Rico. And we work really close to, especially with the teachers. We have a strong relationship with them. Now that the government want to close 300 schools, there's a march that will participate. If the government succeed in closing schools, what we in the mutual centers believe is that some of those schools need to be occupied by the people. Not let the school to be abandoned, because sometimes what happens is that the government succeed in closing and shutting down schools, and we need to bring an alternative there, an alternative system, alternative schools, alternative communities that in a political way build independence with people.
What Giovanni just mentioned in terms of building the alternative, Comedores Sociales, that came out of the University of Puerto Rico, was responding to a very specific need, and it was way ahead of this report that just came out recently about how poor students, especially in universities across America, are literally starving because universities and colleges are either food deserts or the food is just way too expensive. You know, Comedores Sociales had the sort of like the foresight to, in Puerto Rico especially, to try to not only feed students, but also kind of like feed them some knowledge in terms of why that's the case. when Giovanni talks about takeovers, very much like the Young Lords and the Black Panthers, Giovanni, the group that he's working with in Puerto Rico, took over the Social Security Administration building in Caguas. There are so many buildings that are not occupied, that are not being put to any good use all over the island, especially in our town plazas. Those should be the hubs for local social economic activity. Right now, those big box stores like the Walmarts and the Sam's Clubs and all these other BJs and all these other clubs, big box stores, have sucked Puerto Rico dry in terms of the local economies. So this is really the alternative, the new example, the way to go in terms of going back into our pueblos, taking over our plazas, and making these really sustainable places. That's where the jobs are going to be generated, and that's where people are going to want to stay in Puerto Rico, because they do have jobs and they do have hope in creating a new economy and a new way of living.
A lot of the mutual centers are taking over, and we believe that we need a different economy, and we cannot wait until the revolution or to change in the future. We need to start now to build those economical projects that can actually push the reality forward, give hope to people, and maybe in the future we can make our own government. You know.
Giovanni, how do you see these mutual aid centers, which are, correct me if I'm wrong, primarily a food center at this point, feeding into that broader vision? And how do you see, this is your full-time work, most of us as activists, we're at best part-time activists. We sustain ourselves in other ways, and then we do what we can. We go to the meeting now, etc. But this project is your full-time activist work. And I want you to just talk about more that process of being full-time revolutionaries and building towards that self-sustaining economy, which some people might say is about building cooperatives, a cooperative economy towards the end of transformative state power, ultimately.
Well, mutual aid centers are not only food, which is interesting because it started as a food thing, but now we're dealing with so many issues and so many needs that some of the mutual aids are dealing with housing issues. For example, I'm proud of the mutual aid center there. They're doing an extraordinary work with people that lost their houses during the hurricane. And they took over a school, a huge school, that formerly were an agricultural school. And now they're building apartments there. They're building farming. They're building economy with the people. So for my surprise, even, working in comedores, the way people are understanding the necessity of dealing with needs have impressed me, and I'm learning, too, during this process to actually make something different. Now in Caguas, we are cooking less because the necessity of the people is not the food anymore. Now we are in a discussion of how we're going to reorient our work to connect with people's needs. I think that's the way to go forward, to work with people's needs, to make people participate in people's needs. For me, as a full-time job, this is a dream in some way, to be fully working with people. I think revolutionary that wanted to see a change need to be more involved. Something that I usually critique when I was organizing a social organization is that we were all the time working for someone else or working for a capitalist place, and then we only do activists with the time, with the remaining time, which sometimes we are not that professional. And that was something that I was dealing for a lot of years as a social organizer. That's one of the reasons, too, that we created different programs. We want to sustain the programs, to sustain more and more people to work full-time. The capitalists, they work full-time against us. They have the intelligence offices. They have the resource. They have the offices. We need to have the same time. If we're going to face a monster as big as the financial system, as we need our own projects, our own system. I don't know how the future is going to look like. I like cooperatives, but I don't know. I'm not a cooperatist. I think sometimes I refer to our work as an experiment. Sometimes we don't know what to do, to be honest. We function based on intuition, too, because intuition is part of politics, too, and emotion are part of politics, too. And something that we are discussing sometimes there is that we need to add emotions and to add feelings to the thing. And when we work with people's needs, usually we work more with women than with men. That's something important to say, because most of these programs are run, are coordinated, are made by women. And I think that's something really important, because the future is going to look more in a feminist way. We're going to be able to win against the capitalists in Puerto Rico. Women have to be in the front line of the struggle. And I feel proud that at least in some of the programs that we are doing, that is happening. Women are taking a more protagonist role, and they're leading with their feelings and they're leading with the intuition. That's something that I just recently am learning.
When I had an opportunity to speak to Oscar Lopez Rivera when he was here, he was talking about the sustainability of the island and looking at the ecology of the island and gravitating to issues such as solar power and the development of the exploitation, the best exploitation or usage of natural resources of an island nation towards the end of building the economy. And I wonder if there is that kind of cooperative relationship amongst some of the different forces, particularly forces who have inclination to and have supported the independence movement, and looking at that question of the use of the natural environment. And I know, David, you've complained about the rape of the island, its natural resources, and so on. So how does that come to get?
Well, Oscar himself, he's really involved with some of the mutual aid. When I went to Las Marias, which is in the west of Puerto Rico, I was there working with a brigade, and Oscar showed up, and he was working as anyone else. I remember that he was offering us food as part of the brigade, and he was really humble the way he integrated in the brigade. Part of our perspective in the mutual aid centers is that we need sustainability. And we're working strong to have in all the centers, in the all mutual aid center, solar panels. For example, in where I work in Caguas, this Thursday, they're going to install solar panels. And we have a water system recently installed, too, to give people clean water. So we are getting ready for other crises.
Your organization was actually able to get the water system and through
donation. You know, a lot of people are paying attention to what we are doing.
So people are volunteering their labor.
And equipment, and some companies even they want to help people. They know that we're doing the work, so they are helping us to do the work. Now we are an oasis of water. We're going to be fully solar pace, and we are hoping to launch an educational program in August as an educational center there, and maybe a community laundry space so people can join us doing things that they do, but things that can politicize what people are experiencing there.
How many of the centers are doing farming right now?
Maybe half of them, maybe five of them.
There's a huge movement of young people, especially going back to the land. And they're doing a lot of great agriculture and working, you know, with people here on planting seeds and doing a lot of farm. But when Giovanni talks about sustainability and solar energy, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk briefly about an organization that I've always, you know, done work with, which is Casa Pueblo up in the mountains at Adjuntas. It's going to be celebrating their 38th year, you know, in existence. But they've been sort of at the forefront of creating another alternative to dirty fossil fuels for the longest time. They fought two multinational mining companies that wanted to cause all kinds of havoc in the middle of the island. They won that battle. They were effective, or they worked with other groups around the island to also defeat the 92-mile-long gas pipeline in Puerto Rico. You got to remember that Puerto Rico imports 80% to 90% of its energy from dirty fossil fuels, because Puerto Rico doesn't have those kinds of resources. But Puerto Rico being 100 miles by 30 miles in the smack in the, you know, of a big ocean, blessed with the sun and water and everything else, we should be able to move toward a sustainable future. And that's, I think, what something that Maria is helping more and more people see. Somebody in Puerto Rico said Maria has been the great teacher in terms of how we can do things better. We can't go back to a Puerto Rico that operated before that. We got to really look at another model for the way we power Puerto Rico. And Casa Pueblo, for just we're talking about oases, was actually one of those oases right after the storm, because it had solar panels on its roof. It was able to continue to power some medical equipment. People were there able to plug in their phones and so forth and do that sort of thing. And they've been continuing to do that all around Adjuntas, getting people more and more accustomed to the idea of using solar lights, solar generators, and also wind energy. They've powered their transmitter, because they also have Radio Casa Pueblo that transmits and was continuing to transmit throughout the hurricane. And in a couple of weeks, they're going to inaugurate what what I feel is the first solar cinema in Puerto Rico, totally powered by the sun. And it's a model. It's a model. It's in a microcosm. Casa Pueblo and the Kims are showing Puerto Ricanos that there is another future that is within our reach, and that's where we need to run, you know, that's what we need to build toward.
And maybe you think this is a sidebar or somewhat gratuitous, but the struggle for independence, can this happen? Can you continue to develop, or will these things not be crushed unless there is, or how do you integrate in the reality of self-determination, which has been at the heart of the suppression and the destruction of so much, to the point of now driving tens of thousands of people away from the island? How does that kind of politically integrate?
We used to say that freedom or independence, people needed to experience at some way the independence in order to believe in independence. And part of our work is to make able that experience to people, to have the solidarity experience, to have the mutual aid experience, to have the opportunity to decide by ourselves what we're going to do, how we're going to do it. So I strongly believe that if our programs expanded through the island, which we are working to, people can feel what independence is going to look like. And that's part of our effort to actually sustain these programs so people can have that kind of experience.
The question also is how we can help. What do we do to sustain or assist and facilitate the efforts of Giovanni Roberto and, of course, with our good friend David Galarza? So by all means, finish what you were saying. That's really important for Giovanni to share that information.
But there used to be a time when the independence movement, the nationalists, people that supported the independence of Puerto Rico were ridiculed, ostracized, marginalized, and told all kinds of things like, you want to be independent? What, you want to be like Cuba? You want to be poor? Well, we've seen that under the greatest empire, that's exactly what's happening in Puerto Rico. And so there is another alternative. Right now, we're at the crossroads because there are powers out there like the John Paulsons and the hedge funders and the vultures and the fiscal control boards that are trying that have another alternate vision for Puerto Rico. But then there's a more powerful vision of the people, which is what's represented by these CAMs and different organizations in Puerto Rico that are providing that alternate vision. Right after the storm, you know, so many Puerto Ricans here knew that there were organizations like Comedores Sociales and Casa Pueblo that they could automatically turn to because they were already doing the job. And so it was a, you know, great relief and pleasure to be able to do that, to support that. But Giovanni, tell us about
How do we support you?
Well, two ways. First, our webpage. You can go to our webpage. It's cdpeakpr.org.
Do that one more time.
cdpeakpr.org, or you can go to Facebook and search for us, Comedores Sociales de Puerto Rico.
CDPECPR.
And you could also donate. And you could also donate on that page. And please give, and give generously.
Absolutely. And I just want to say that it's been an honor, a pleasure, and we've got to step up to the plate. And we're going to hear more about the fact that lots of our sisters and brothers from Puerto Rico, who've been living here, who've been driven from the island, we hope temporarily, are about to have their FEMA benefits cut off. So we've got a lot of work to do with people in the diaspora here as well. And I know, of course, David Galarza, we're going to have him back to talk more about that. And Giovanni Roberto, it is an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
Those LGBT people who have grown up in the Islamic tradition, what psychological effect does it have on their well-being?
As a friend of mine who's an academic said, it's similar to being involved in a severe car accident where you have to go into rehabilitation to recover. So I thought, okay, how can I facilitate a platform where we can provide healing?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A Day Against Queer Phobias strikes a global chord. Undercover Cameroon cops crash the capital's gay venues, and a gay imam makes peace with Islam. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michelle Yater.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending May 19th, 2018. The annual International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia was observed around the world on May 17th with a wide variety of events. This year's theme was Alliances for Solidarity. Rainbow colors, from flags and balloons to building lights and artwork displays, characterized several observances in Australia. Exhibitions and panel discussions marked the day in Bolivia, Brazil, Croatia, Costa Rica, France, Honduras, Serbia, Sri Lanka, and the UK. Guatemalan activists held their sixth annual Walk Against Homophobia, while similar marches and rallies were held in Cuba, El Salvador, and South Africa. And in their observance of the International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia, the American Psychological Association counted some 125 bills targeting LGBTQ rights that have been introduced within the past year in the United States during a press briefing at the Rayburn House office building in Washington, D.C.
Uganda's ironically named Minister for Ethics and Integrity, Simon Lokoto, canceled an International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia observance in Kampala, literally minutes before it was scheduled to begin. Security forces ordered people to disperse because the event was illegally promoting homosexuality. Frank Mugisha of the organizing group Sexual Minorities Uganda said that it's very unfortunate that this kind of harassment continues to happen. In fact, it is the reason we organize such events.
Several dozen people demonstrated in the Georgian capital of Tbilisi to mark the day, defying an official government ban. Authorities feared violent clashes between LGBTQ activists and followers of the Georgian Orthodox Church, which had organized rallies for family purity on the same day. One queer action involved releasing smoking flares in an array of rainbow colors on a hilltop above the city, while in another, activists held up signs and chanted against homophobia outside the Prime Minister's office. There were minor scuffles throughout the day between churchgoers and queer rights supporters, but no major incidents were reported.
The organizer of an 8-day Pride Festival, scheduled for May 12th through 20th in Beirut, was forced to cancel most of the events, including a commemoration of the International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia, after Lebanese authorities threatened to prosecute him for immorality. Hadi Damian was arrested at one of the kickoff events, an Arabic language reading of a theater text about homophobia, and held overnight in an overcrowded cell before agreeing, on the advice of his attorney, to sign a pledge to cancel all remaining Pride events. Prosecutors wanted to charge him with organizing events considered to be inciting immorality and disturbance of public morals.
A video posted to China's popular Twitter-like social media website Weibo
shows Beijing security forces assaulting a small group of activists commemorating the International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia by trying to hand out rainbow badges in the city's hip arts district. Two women are seen being attacked by police officers, and one is knocked to the ground. Organizers said both women had to be hospitalized. Weibo subsequently removed the video without explanation. China was also banned this week from continuing to broadcast the globally popular Eurovision Song Contest, a particular queer fan favorite, after officials censored a performance by an entry from Ireland that featured two male dancers and rainbow flags.
25 men were arrested this week during raids on gay venues in Cameroon's capital city of Yaoundé. Same-gender sex is illegal in the Central African nation, punishable by up to 5 years in prison. In one raid, police officers posing as customers broke down the door of a popular night spot after staff told them that the place was closed. Seven people, including a waiter, dancer, and security guard, were among the detainees. 18 more were arrested at a movie theater known to be a favorite queer hangout. Police Commander Parfait Nana told local media that two people had been released because they were witnesses. The remaining 23 will be interrogated, he said, and conclusions will be reached at the close of the investigations. According to some reports, the torturous interrogation that continued over a two-day period included being denied food and water, or worse. All of the remaining 23 detainees were released soon thereafter without charge or explanation. One of them told reporters that, "Despite threats by the police, we kept our cool. We were brutalized," he said, "and then we were released."
Russia's Justice Minister Alexander Konovalov told representatives from the United Nations Human Rights Council this week that there are no LGBT people in the country's mostly Muslim region of Chechnya. Therefore, he claimed, there could not have been the alleged purge of such people reported in recent months. A spokesperson for Chechen strongman and Vladimir Putin ally Ramzan Kadyrov had already told reporters that you cannot arrest or repress people who just don't exist in the republic. Konovalov told a working group of the UN's Human Rights Council that his office had taken the allegations seriously and looked into them. As for gay people in Chechnya, he said, we weren't able to find any. Those statements fly in the face of numerous reputable media accounts of LGBT Chechens being rounded up, placed in secret detention camps, and tortured until they revealed the names of everyone they knew. Several deaths during detention were reported. Belgium, Canada, France, and Germany are among the countries that have already granted asylum to fearful sexual minorities fleeing Chechnya. Russian officials have tried to counter concerns expressed in a number of other countries about the treatment of queer fans attending the FIFA World Cup matches this June in Moscow by saying that they have nothing to fear.
Updating a story we've been following for the past several weeks, Hong Kong's immigration department has quietly started to issue spousal visas to the foreign partners of legally wed same-gender couples, just as they automatically do for heterosexual couples. At the same time, the department is challenging a court of appeal ruling ordering it to issue a spousal visa to the British wife of a lesbian who had moved to Hong Kong for work. A hearing in the city's Court of Final Appeal is scheduled for June 4th. According to a report this week in Pink News, the department calls the spousal visas it's now issuing to the partners of legally wed same-gender couples out of policy until the courtroom battles are resolved. The visas grant resident status, a national ID card, and access to educational and employment opportunities. If the immigration department wins its appeal, the foreign same-gender spouses of Hong Kong residents will again only be able to get extended tourist visas to stay in the city.
In other news, U.S. President Donald Trump continues to wreak havoc on LGBT rights advances made by the Obama administration. Trump's latest policy reversal says that biological sex should be the main determining factor on where to house transgender prison inmates, presumably forcing vulnerable transgender women to share cells with men. However, the Bureau of Prisons couldn't tell BuzzFeed News this week how biological sex is being defined, nor how officials would, in fact, decide who is transgender and who isn't. According to the online news site, a representative from the Bureau first said that they would look into the question, but followed up the following day with, "We decline to comment further." And no one will say if current transgender inmates will be transferred to other prisons because of the new policy. ACLU attorney Chase Strangio, who's represented transgender prisoners, said that while determining someone's biological sex might seem obvious, it is anything but. He pointed out that it could be defined by a person's birth certificate, chromosomes, anatomy, or other factors. The new policy also fails to address where intersex inmates would be housed.
In better news for the U.S. trans community, Vermont's Republican Governor Phil Scott signed a bill into law this week requiring all single-user public bathrooms in the state to be explicitly gender-neutral. The landmark measure affects bathrooms in government buildings, shops, schools, and recreational facilities. In his signing statement, Scott wrote that, "This is especially important for kids in school who face anxiety and bullying over something as simple as using the restroom." But a transgender rights bill was killed this week in the Republican-controlled New York State Senate. And according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, lawmakers in 13 states so far this year have considered bills to limit access to public bathrooms in some way.
And finally, from her public heterosexual persona and character on Sex and the City to saying she's bisexual, Cynthia Nixon has now come full circle as she challenges from the left sitting Democratic New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who's seeking another term. The fledgling candidate floated a new campaign slogan during her recent appearance at the annual Legislative Correspondents Association dinner in Albany.
Vote for the homo, not for the Cuomo.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending May 19th, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazor, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the newly renovated thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Yeader.
And I'm John Dyer V.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights. An informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out.
What does the Quran say about homosexuality in the original translation?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. The term is non-existent.
How can Islam and homosexuality be compatible?
I am Muslim. I am a gay man. I'm a father. I'm a lover. I'm a person of color. You know, we cannot put this human identity in a binary code.
Imam Noor Warsami shared those words of wisdom on the last This Way Out. The gay Melbourne, Australia-based cleric now goes on to talk about healing the effects of religious violence in all faiths and about some hopeful developments in the Muslim community. He spoke in a Sydney park during this year's Mardi Gras with our correspondent, Barry McKay.
For those LGBT people who have grown up in the Islamic tradition, what psychological effect does it have on their well-being and psychological health to be told this conservative viewpoint? What internal conflicts do they face?
As a friend of mine who's an academic said that when a child is natural emotions, you know, we even in different parts of the world, we haven't been taught emotional literacy. So I remember when I was growing up, you know, men don't cry, you're told. So you're suppressing a natural human emotion. The trauma that that causes, and that's on an emotional level, on a spiritual level, to me it's in the same wavelength, it's the same weight. This academic refers, she says it's similar to being involved in a severe car accident, where you have to go into rehabilitation and take months to recover. So it is, and sometimes you recover fully, sometimes you don't recover fully, but that trauma always stays with you. It's irreversible, the damage that that does. I have thankfully just found ways of managing it, but it's irreversible.
Is there any way of remedying this within the confines of the Islamic faith?
That's why we have started. When I started the group in November 2013, there was a vacuum in the support services, particularly of LGBTIQ queer Muslim youth. I mean, I started Marhaba for LGBT Muslim young people. Then we had Jewish members, because people have partners, you know, and they would bring their partners, and, you know, people that have been traumatized by their Catholic background. My ex-boyfriend of 10 years was a Catholic man who hated anything to do with the church. And it took me a long time even to understand that. So I thought, okay, how can I facilitate a platform where we can provide healing for the damage that has been done with this religious hierarchy, and also see if we can reconcile spirituality with sexuality and not let go of one to have the other. And it has been thankfully effective thus far.
For an LGBTIQ person who is listening to this program, struggling with their sexuality, who's grown up in the Islamic faith, what message would you have for them?
I say, you know, hang in there. There's an alternative. And, you know, reach out. See where there is avenues and reach out. Reach out for help. Don't just suppress it, because trauma that is suppressed will always manifest itself later on in different ways.
In your opinion, why did God or Allah make LGBTIQ people?
Why did God make black people? Why did God make Asian people, white people? You know, it is. And you know, there's a verse that comes to mind now that you asked that, Barry. You know, wa min ayatihi, and from the signs of God. وَاخْتِلَافُ أَلْسِنَتِكُمْ وَأَلْوَانِكُمْ, the different tongues that we speak, the different languages, the different dialects, the different colors that you see of humans. One person is white, one person is black, one person is Asian, one person is tall, one person is short. So these are different signs of God's creation. Like, you have all these different plants, different animals, different. So, but we can't say, you know, okay, if you want to be this, you have to be this. You cannot encompass something that God has himself created to live freely. You know, you can't put it in a bottle, so to speak.
But it is something that challenges patriarchy, which is the dominant, I guess, ideology around the world in many countries, not only in the Islamic world, but also in many other parts of the world too.
And that's why there is this violent reaction. Historically, it has existed. We went through these training workshops where we went through the stories of Sodom and Gomorrah. Some people that wanted to understand the texts. So we went through them. They said, oh, wow, we can't believe it's not even there, the term. And people will give you different ways of how they think. But the one thing I found was that it is a threat to patriarchy, the masculinity. What is, you know, my father, for example, would say, men don't go in the kitchen. You know, it's a woman's role. A friend of mine said, you know, when his wife wanted to get a job, he said, oh, but babe, who's going to cook the food? Who's going to look after the kids? So there's this gender and roles that we inherit somehow.
But those roles, I suppose, are starting to break down in the West.
Yes.
In the Islamic world, they're still quite rigid, would you say?
There are. We are going, though, through that change. You know, change doesn't happen in a lifetime. But there is a change happening. Last night, I was speaking at an event at Sydney University, the first Sydney Queer Muslim Symposium. And you should have seen, Barry, the number of people, academics, physicians. One of the physicians was a general practitioner in somewhere in Western Sydney, where it's predominantly Arab people there, or Muslim people. But she said, you know, even in a professional setting, we feel gagged, you know, because we don't know how to address this. But there is a shift happening. People are coming out to find alternatives, you know. I said, the fact that you're here, it's for a change shift to happen, agents for change are needed. And, you know, it cannot be left to other people to do it.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
As with the Bible, is it a case of needing to read the Quran in the text of the times in which it was written in terms of any passages that could be conceived as being anti-LGBTIQ?
Absolutely. I mean, you're talking about a scripture that was revealed 6th century, 7th century, where Arabs used to bury their daughters alive out of shame. I have a daughter, I'm a father of a daughter. There's a verse that says, وَإِذَا بُشِّرَ أَحَدُهُمْ بِالْأُنْثَى, when one of them is told the good news of a female child, ظَلَّ وَجْهُهُ مُسْوَدًّا وَهُوَ كَظِيمٌ, his face will turn out of anger. And then his friends will make fun of him. Oh, look, look, he's got a daughter. So it was such a... bury them. Take the child and go to the desert of Arabia, dig a hole and bury the child alive.
Out of shame.
And there's another verse, وَإِذَا الْمَوْءُودَةُ سُئِلَتْ بِأَيِّ ذَنْبٍ قُتِلَتْ, that day will come on the day of judgment when that child that was buried alive will ask God, what have I done to deserve this? For it was such a society that he came to. For him to, within a period of 23 years, to have women allow them to have half inheritance of a man, I think to me, in 23-year period for such a society, was in itself revolutionary. From being buried alive to having some sort of rights in leadership and so forth. So it needs to be contextualized. The context of some of those verses, it was talking to that society, a society that, as I said, maniacal in their way of thinking. And sadly, 1,338, 39 years later, some Muslims and some other religious denominations do that in the name of religion, not necessarily physically, like it used to happen back then, but they would bury their child, you know, like what happens to the LGBT queer young people being condemned simply because they are not following a particular, you're not Muslim if you don't do this, or you have to get married, or, you know. And that's a form of burial because, you know, the effects that it has.
There are a lot of LGBTIQ people in the Islamic world who feel the pressure, I suppose, from society, from the family to get married. And live a secret life, I suppose.
Well, you're talking with one. I was married. I fathered a daughter. And, you know, my ex-wife, she loved me. Loved me. And I loved her. And I was told, you know, just get married, it will go away. Because at that time I was on young imam who thought I would, you know, I was on the board of Imams of Victoria, the youngest back then. I like to describe myself then like a young bull, you know. And I was fat back then. Thinking I would change the world. But I was told, you know, get married. You know, this don't act on it. It will go away. And I lasted 1 year, and I never cheated on her, thank heavens. But I had a problem with that. I had a problem with other men. As a man who was an imam, I saw this happening on a large scale. I saw men that were married with children and would be leading double life. They would go to gay saunas as they're driving taxi, and they would go into gay apps, and they would go home to the wife who's looking after the children and lead that double life. So I had a problem with that. Other thing I had a problem with is people letting go of the spirituality because they said, oh, you know, I've been kicked out of the mosque or out of the church or out of the temple because I'm gay. Or I said, well, no, who can dictate your soul to you? It's your soul. And so I thought, okay, how can I facilitate something in between.
Are there any signs in Muslim majority countries of the growing acceptance of LGBTIQ people in 2018, do you think?
Even if the acceptance is there, it wouldn't be publicized. But what I am fascinated about is not the acceptance of the hierarchy, because the old school of thought, this mentality that's very Wahhabi oriented, is controlling, you know. The Saudi government now coming across as if they are doing changes, but the leadership and specifically the imams, the power that they have, is very tight on. And young people who want to live freely, who a lot of Saudi young people have been educated in the West, and they have this freedom, but they go back and they have to submit. But young people are finding ways. Interestingly, finding ways to be artistic, to be innovative, and to reclaim their
spiritual and sexual identities.
Is there any opposition from the more conservative Islamic leadership in Australia?
You know, I think by me coming out, it was a big shock for many of the imams. I am trained, as many as the other imams are. I've memorized the Quran, alhamdulillah. So I think one of the reasons I haven't had any backlash from the leadership in particular is because they know I'm not one who will be easily intimidated, and I will rebut whatever they come up with. So I think that has been a privilege, and I'm not trying to knock on wood, but as they say, I said to the guys in Sydney here, no, don't be frightened, don't let them frighten you. And if they come and say whatever theological arguments to put doubts in your mind, I said I will counter that. There is patriarchy and there's what I call gaytriarchy. There are well-established organizations. Like I said, I had experience in Melbourne, established organizations who have gone through the same issues that I'm talking about and Muslims are going through 30 years ago, 40 years ago. However, it seems that we forget. The word for human in Arabic is insan. Insan is derived from the word nisyan, forgetful. Generally, when we get in a comfortable position, we forget, so there is still a need, and I think established LGBT organizations globally should look for, groups that are starting up. And if you look, you will find people reaching out.
Are there movements in other countries around the world to establish LGBTIQ-friendly mosques, and how successful have they been?
I know Imam Lutovic, for example, who started the first LGBT-friendly mosque in France, Paris. Mohsen Hendricks is a man. One of the first LGBT gay imams. 20-year activism, and he started Al Fitra organization. And he has his own congregation where they conduct prayers. There's facilities for mosques and so forth. There is the one in Germany. There is the inclusive mosque in England, London. So there are places, and they have been very, very successful. Very successful. So Australia, we are next.
Good. Yes. Finally, if anyone listening to this program would like to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
So my website, imamnur.com, imamnur.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Imam Noor.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
This is Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia, for This Way Out.
You can see the video of Barry Mackay's complete conversation with Imam Noor Warsami at the all-new thiswayout.org. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Michelle Yater and John Dyer V, with thanks to Brian DeShazer, and from Barry Mackay. Ryan Eno and David Byrne performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the all-new thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Arusha Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We all thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WDFH Ossining, New York, 3PVR Mill Park, Victoria, KCSB Santa Barbara, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA and kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. I have a hunch that while some listeners who give to KPFA want a thank you gift in the form of a DVD, book, or other item, other listeners are interested in an experience, and perhaps even an experience that involves meeting a programmer at KPFA. So today we offer you an experience with me as your companion, and that experience is a group discussion, a book group discussion, focusing on a piece of classic literature, Fyodor Dostoevsky's novel, Notes from Underground. This book group will meet twice. There will be two sessions of 2 hours each that I will facilitate on the second Thursday of September and of October. That's the evenings of September 13th and October 11th, to take place in Berkeley at a location to be determined. For a $300 pledge to KPFA, you can request as your thank you gift participation in those two book group sessions plus a copy of Notes from Underground by Dostoevsky. Again, your thank you gift for a pledge of $300 or more to KPFA is participation in this two-session book group discussion and the book Notes from Underground, considered by many to be Dostoevsky's first masterpiece. We're trying to limit attendance to a maximum of 12 people, plus myself. So if you're interested in this experience, and I'd love to meet you and discuss and explore this amazing book with you, pick up your phone and call this number sooner rather than later, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Again, the two book discussion sessions will take place on Thursday, September 13th and Thursday, October 11th from 7 to 9 in the evening in Berkeley at a place to be announced. So how do I tempt you to make that pledge and join our book group? I'll do that by presenting excerpts of an audiobook of Notes from Underground, an audiobook narrated by the veteran actor Stacy Keach. That audiobook is part of a sprawling compilation called Voices That Change the World, which features more than 1,300 hours of some of the best programs and presentations and talks and performances aired on KPFA and Pacifica Radio over the course of almost 7 decades. In fact, for a pledge of $200, you get 1,300 plus hours of historic audio on a USB drive. The voices of John Lennon, Paul Robeson, Kate Clinton, and George Carlin are also on this compilation. And this hour, you'll hear from those folks as well. So again, a pledge of $300 makes you a participant in the two-session book group. Plus, it gets you a copy of the book Notes from Underground. And or a pledge of $200 gets you the Voices That Change the World compilation that includes 1,300 plus hours of historic audio, including a complete unabridged audiobook reading of Notes from Underground. Let's begin then with an excerpt of Stacy Keach, the veteran actor, reading Fyodor Dostoevsky's book Notes from Underground.
I was 24. But even then, I led the gloomy, disorganized, solitary existence of a recluse. I stayed away from people, avoided even speaking to them, and kept more and more to my hole. At the office, I avoided looking at anyone. I realized that the others regarded me as eccentric, and even, so at least I felt, viewed me with a sort of disgust. Why, I wondered sometimes, did no one else feel that he was inspiring disgust in others? There was a clerk there with a repulsive, pockmarked face. In fact, he was quite sinister-looking. I wouldn't have had the courage to even show such a mug to anyone. Another clerk's clothes were so dirty that he smelled, but neither clerk seemed in the least perturbed by his face, his clothes, or by, I don't know, any mental quirk he might have had. It didn't occur to either fellow that he might inspire loathing. And even if it had, neither of them would have given a damn, unless the loathing came from their superiors. Now, it is absolutely clear to me that because of an infinite vanity that caused me to set myself impossible standards, I regarded myself with furious disapproval, bordering on loathing, then ascribed my own feelings to everyone I came across. I hated my face. I found it odious, and even suspected that there was something slimy in its expression. So, on arriving at the office, I always tried to assume a casual air and a dignified expression so I wouldn't be suspected of cringing. Let my face be plain, I thought, as long as it's dignified, expressive, and above all, incredibly intelligent. I was painfully aware, however, that my facial expression could not possibly convey all these qualities. And worse yet, while I'd have settled for anything as long as it looked intelligent, I found my face positively stupid. I'd have even accepted a depraved expression if at the same time everyone had agreed that I had a terribly intelligent face. I, of course, loathed and despised everyone in my office, although I was afraid of them at the same time. At times, I even considered them above me. I kept shifting from one extreme to the other for no apparent reason. One day I'd despise them, the next I'd feel they were my betters. A civilized, self-respecting man cannot be vain without setting unattainably high standards for himself and despising himself at certain moments. But when I came across anyone, whether I admired or despised him, I always lowered my eyes first. I even tested myself to see whether I could withstand the look of this or that person, but I was always the first to yield. This tormented me and drove me mad with rage. I also had a morbid fear of appearing ridiculous, so I slavishly adhered to all of the external conventions. I stuck enthusiastically to the ordinary and abhorred all signs of eccentricity in me. But what chance did I have? I was painfully sensitive and complex, as a man of this age should be. The others, of course, were stupid and resembled one another like a flock of sheep. Perhaps I was the only one in the office to feel that I was a coward and a slave. I felt that because I was more highly developed than the others. But then it was not simply a feeling. I really was a coward and a slave. I say this without any shame. Every self-respecting man today must be a coward and a slave. That is now his normal state. I'm deeply convinced of it. That's how he's made. As a matter of fact, it's not only true of our age and isn't due to any particular set of circumstances. It goes for all times. A self-respecting man is bound to be a coward and a slave. This is a natural law governing every self-respecting man. Even if he manages once in a while to show a little courage, there's no need for him to be smug about it, for he's sure to lie down under the next blow. It is the age-old solution, the only way out. Only asses make a show of courage, and even then, only until they come up against the wall. But why bother about them anyway, since they are of no importance? Another thing worried me then. I was unlike everyone else, and everyone else was unlike me. I'm all alone, while there are a lot of them, I mused. This goes to show that I was still just a boy. Sometimes I went from one extreme to the other in my behavior. Sometimes I simply couldn't stand going back to the office. I would return home from it completely sick and broken. Then suddenly I would go through a phase of cynical indifference. With me, everything happened in phases. I would laugh at my own finicky intolerance, teasing myself for my romantic notions. One day I'd refuse to talk to my colleagues at all. Then suddenly I'd be talking their heads off and even seeking their friendship. All my disgust would just vanish for no apparent reason. But possibly I'd never really felt it in the first place and had simply been affecting something I'd picked up out of books. At one time, I became really friendly with my co-workers. I began visiting them at their homes, played cards with them, drank vodka in their company, talked with them about promotions.
That's the actor Stacy Keach reading from Fyodor Dostoevsky's book, Notes from Underground. We'll turn in a moment to other voices from the sprawling Voices That Change the World compilation, which features Cornel West, Rachel Carson, Alan Watts, Fannie Lou Hamer, Aldous Huxley, Dolores Huerta, and hundreds of other legendary figures. But I want to tell you again that I'm convening a book group that will discuss in two sessions this novel, Notes from Underground. Those two sessions will be on September 13th and October 11th. Those are both Thursdays, from 7 to 9 p.m. in Berkeley, for at a place to be determined. For a $300 pledge to KPFA, you can request as your thank you gift participation in those two book group sessions, plus your own copy of Notes from Underground by Dostoevsky. I'll facilitate the two sessions, and it'll be a pleasure to meet you and talk about a piece of great literature, a novel fundamentally about ideas and about the human condition. We are trying to limit attendance to a maximum of 12 people. So once those 12 slots are gone, they're gone. So if you're interested, call this number as soon as you can. It is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Now, we are also offering, for a $200 pledge, the audio compilation of some of the best of Pacifica Radio over the course of more than six decades. The compilation is called, again, Voices That Change the World, and it consists of more than 1,300 hours of historic audio on a USB drive. That compilation, as I said before, includes a complete unabridged audiobook of Notes from Underground. It also includes the voice of Paul Robeson, the phenomenally gifted singer, actor, athlete, and political activist. Pete Seeger called Robeson one of the greatest human beings of all time. Paul Robeson spoke at the studios of KPFA 60 years ago. That would be 1958. He was joined by Elsa Knight Thompson, KPFA's Director of News and Public Affairs, and Harold Winkler, President of the Pacifica Foundation. Here's the larger-than-life Paul Robeson.
I feel any Negro, if you were honest, would have to say that even in our democracy as at present, that he is never any one second unconscious of the fact that he is a black American or a colored American. He can never be unconscious of it in any part of the United States. What is most important is that at the height, having lived many years out and enjoying the certainly the height of success in Great Britain, that I decided that I must come back to my own country to struggle in this and to make the sacrifices that I have. That's the most important thing in this regard. There are many places in the world where personally it would be much easier to live than in the United States for an American Negro. And Langston Hughes, in a book discussion before the book club in New York just a while ago, pointed out that every important Negro novelist, not only Richard Wright, but many others, that the great 95% of them live in Paris or somewhere else in the world. Mm. Why? Because the pressures personally are much simpler.
And yet, in the foreword of your book that I have before me, you quote Frederick Douglass as saying, "A man is worked on by what he works on."
That's right.
"He may carve out his circumstances, but his circumstances will carve him out as well."
That's right.
Is this part of the reason why you feel that you must be back in the United States?
I made this decision some years ago. I say certainly that I spring essentially from here, like you threw the other day about the Indians in North Carolina. If you recall, that was in Robeson County. Now, this is a very interesting thing which I point out in my book and which explains a good deal, too, of how I feel. Now, I was born on the edge of Robeson County, and my father is a Robeson and was a Robeson because he was a slave, my own father, a slave of the Scottish Robesons who still control Robeson County in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I approach these problems from a very close point. But I have a home, and my people are tobacco workers and sharecroppers today on plantations in that county. But a part of that soil belongs to me. That's my roots. These are my roots in this country. The other great change is very constant in my mind. I was in the Welsh Valley, and the Welsh people sing very much like we do in the Negro people, beautiful songs. And I was one of the few outsiders who has sung at a Welsh Eisteddfod, their national festival, which has gone on since the time of the Druids. And I went down in the mines with the workers, and they explained to me that, "Paul, you may be successful here in England, but your people suffer like ours. We are poor people, and you belong to us. You don't belong to the bigwigs here in this country." And so I today feel as much at home in the Welsh Valley as I would in my own Negro section, any city in the United States. And I just did a broadcast by transatlantic cable to the Welsh Valley a few weeks ago. And here was the first understanding that the struggle of the Negro people, or of any people, cannot be by itself. That it is a human struggle. And so I was attracted then met many members of the Labor Party, and my politics embraced also the common struggle of all oppressed peoples, including especially the working masses, specifically the laboring people of all the world. And that defines my philosophy. It's a joining one of, we are a working people, a laboring people, the Negro people. And there is a unity between our struggle and those of white workers. In the South, I've had white workers shake my hand and say, "Paul, we're fighting for the same thing." And so this defines my attitude toward socialism and toward many other things in the world. I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership in the interest of all.
Is that a democratic socialism, or?
I would have to be a democratic socialism. There are many ways, however, to struggle toward democracy, as I see that in a place like China, for example, today, the Soviet Union, many other places, or take our own problems of Negroes. If we were free in the South tomorrow to carry our weight, to vote into everything, would we now look around and try to find the 10 billionaires among our people? Would we attempt to build them up, or would we try to answer the needs of the great millions of our people? And so I see other ways of life, socialism, as trying to solve the problems of millions and tens of millions of peoples at once. I have made the decision to join in a collective struggle. So nothing is perfect in the world. We're going toward it from different angles. I feel there's a great burden of proof on every society, on our own as well, today. And I become interested in the music of Bartok, of Mussorgsky, many folk things, the unity of the folk music of the world, which has sprung from my political conviction that all people should be unified. I have seen it expressed in their music, and I do a program, which of all the songs of all the peoples in the world, suggesting that we are all one human family. It all comes to that. So I feel that basically, that it has deepened my. On the other hand, I have never separated my work as an artist from my work as a human being. I've always put it even more strongly that, to me, my art is always a weapon. It's got to be good art. Othello was a weapon in racial relations, or at least showing that we can do some things too. I played football. My father explained to me that, well, Othello hit me, I couldn't hit him back because they'd say we were bad and savage, so I had to stand and be knocked all around. I had to do well in my studies, so I've never been able to divorce one thing from the other. And luckily, I don't sing the kind of songs that you're here and you hit the high, whatever it is, the high B-flat and the high this and the high that. I sing songs that express very much the emotions of different peoples, like the Welsh, the Scotch, the Negro, Chinese, Russian, and so forth. But I am very happy to get to the core, be back at my singing, and to say that, however I have talked this afternoon, that I have great faith, and I wouldn't be here if I did not have great faith that somewhere we will realize the democratic potentials of our life, of our society. I deeply believe that. I fight for peace. I feel we've got to live with many other kinds of systems and other beliefs in the world. We've been able to do it through many generations and centuries. That's the reason why we could find peace and not destruction, and a little faster in understanding the problems of oppressed peoples, wherever they may be.
That was Paul Robeson speaking at the studios of KPFA on February 8th, 1958. He is part of a 1,300-plus-hour Pacifica Radio Archives audio compilation called Voices That Change the World. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on KPFA. And also on that compilation are George Carlin, Kate Clinton, and John Lennon. In this next clip, you'll first hear George Carlin, after which the comedian Kate Clinton tells a story, after which John Lennon will talk and sing a bit and talk a bit more.
Yeah, there are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are 7 of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993
to 7. They must really be bad.
They'd have to be outrageous to be separated from a group that large. All of you over here, you 7.
Bad word.
That's what they told us they were, remember?
That's a bad word.
No bad words. Bad thoughts. Bad intentions. And words. You know the 7, don't you, that you can't say on television?
Huh? From George Carlin's Filthy Words monologue that aired on WBAI on October 30th, 1973.
Well, there's a lot going on there, man. Besides the literal translation and the emotional feeling, I mean, they're just busy words. There's a lot of syllables to contend with. And those K's, those are aggressive sounds. They jump out at you, man. It's like an assault on you, you know? So I can dig that. Now, we mentioned earlier, of course, and 2 of the other 4-letter Anglo-Saxon words are and which go together, of course, but forget that. A little accidental humor I throw there. The reason that are on the list is that a long time ago, certain ladies said, those are the 2 I'm not going to say. I don't mind f***ing s***, but P and C are out. P and C are out. Which led to such stupid sentences as, okay, you f***, I'm going to tinkle now. Forget those 7, they're out. But there are some 2-way words, those double-meaning words. Remember the ones you giggled at in 6th grade? And the cock crowed 3 times.
Hey, the cock crowed 3 times. Hey, it's in the Bible.
There are some 2-way words, like it's okay for Kurt Gowdy to say, Roberto Clemente has 2 balls on him. But he can't say, I think he hurt his b- on that play, Tony, don't you? He's holding them. He must have hurt them, by God. It's an interesting word.
The word that leads a double life, the word.
First of all, it means sometimes, most of the time, what does it mean? It means to make love, right?
We're going to make love, hey? We're going to make love, right?
And it also means the beginning of life. It's the act that begins life. So there's the word hanging around with words like love and life. And yet, on the other hand, it's also a word that we really use to hurt each other with, man. It's a heavy, it's one that you save toward the end of the argument, right? So you finally can't make... Ah, f*** you, man! It's a stupid f*** you and everybody that looks like you!
This is a true story. A friend of mine was looking in the paper. She saw an ad, and it said, 1980, slate blue, Mercedes-Benz, $85. My friend called the number and says, I'm here calling about the Mercedes-Benz. Is this true? And the woman says, absolutely. She says, come on up, try it. My friend goes up, and there in the driveway is a 1980 slate blue Mercedes-Benz, a sport de coupe. I'm talking a suede roof, okay? We got a car. She goes up to the door. She says to the woman, I'm here about the car. And the woman says, well, it's right there. And my friend says, well, has it got a motor in it? The woman says, yeah, it's got a motor in it. Take it out for a test drive. My friend takes it out for a test drive. It's gorgeous, just beautiful. She comes back and she says, well, if this $85 is no misprint, just write you a check right now. And the woman said, yep, $85. My friend writes out the check for $85. They exchange the papers, and the woman is giving her the keys to my friend, and she says, wouldn't you like to know about this car? My friend says, yes, I'd like to know about this car. And the woman says, well, I'm 67 years old, and my husband is 70 years old, and last month he left me for a 21-year-old woman. 2 days ago, I got a postcard from him, and it said, I'm in Florida, need money, sell the car. Thank you very much.
In the fall of 1971, inmates at the Attica State Prison in New York seized hostages and demanded improved conditions. Governor Nelson Rockefeller ordered 1,500 armed police and state troopers to storm the prison. They killed 31 prisoners and 9 hostages. A benefit concert was held at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. John and Yoko headed the bill.
I'd just like to say it's an honor and a pleasure to be here at the Apollo, and for the reasons we're all here. Some of you might wonder what I'm doing here with no drummers and no nothing like that. Well, you might know I lost my old band, or I left it. I'm putting an electric band together, but it's not ready yet, and these things like this keep coming up, so I have to just busk it. So I'm going to sing a song now you might know. It's called Imagine. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky. Imagine all. I am not aiming at 16-year-olds. If they can dig it, please dig it. But when I was singing and writing this and working with her, I was visualizing all the people of my age group from the 60s.
That's true.
Being in their 30s and 40s now, just like me, and having wives and children, and having gone through everything together, I'm singing to them. I hope the young kids like it as well, but I'm really talking to the people that grew up with me. I'm saying, here I am now. How are you? How's your relationship going? Did you get through it all? Wasn't the 70s a drag, you know? Here we are. Well, let's try and make the 80s good, you know? Because it's still up to us to make what we can of it. Now, maybe in the 60s we were naive, And like children, everybody went back to their room and said, well, we didn't get a wonderful world of just flowers and peace and happy chocolate. And it wasn't just pretty and beautiful all the time. And that's what everybody did. We didn't get everything we wanted, just like babies. And everybody went back to their rooms and sulked. And we're just going to play rock and roll and not do anything else. We're going to stay in our rooms. And the world is a nasty, horrible place because it didn't give us everything we cried for. Right? Crying for it wasn't enough. The thing the 60s did was show us the possibility and the responsibility that we all had. It wasn't the answer, it just gave us a glimpse of the possibility.
And that was John Lennon, and before that, Kate Clinton, and before that, George Carlin, sharing what they do and what they know. And this is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA, and I'm C.S. Song. And you can get the Voices That Change the World compilation. This is a curated collection of some of the best programs and presentations and talks and performances aired on KPFA and Pacifica Radio over the course of almost 7 decades. That is your thank you gift. And by the way, that's not 12 hours or 120 hours, but 1,200, actually more than 1,300 hours on a USB drive. You can get that 1,300-plus hour compilation as your thank you gift for a pledge of $200 or more to KPFA. And the phone number here is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org, 1-800-439-5732. What do you get on this compilation? You get the voices of, oh, I don't know, people like Muhammad Ali and Molly Ivins and Jim Hightower and Fannie Lou Hamer and Karen Armstrong and Rachel Carson, Sister Helen Prejean and James Baldwin and June Jordan and Angela Davis and Thich Nhat Hanh and Alan Watts and Dolores Huerta and Pauline Kael and Murray Bookchin and Frank Zappa and Carlos Castaneda and Dick Gregory and Fidel Castro and Gary Snyder and Toni Morrison and Ed Asner and Joan Baez and Mario Savio and Alan Watts and Neil deGrasse Tyson, on and on and on. It goes 1,300-plus hours of classic historic audio, and that is yours for a pledge of just $200, which you can break down into 6 monthly installments, which you can really break any pledge down to KPFA down into. You can break that down into 6 monthly installments, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And this Voices That Change the World compilation includes a number of audiobooks, including audiobooks of George Orwell's 1984, and that sounds pretty relevant to today, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, Tolstoy's War and Peace, that's a pretty long audiobook, I imagine, and Fyodor Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. And we are offering this hour for a $300 pledge, and you need to call the number. You can't do this online. You need to call the number 1-800-439-5732. We are offering for a $300 pledge an invitation to a book group discussion of what many consider Dostoevsky's first masterpiece, Notes from Underground, plus a copy of that novel. So you get the novel and you get tickets to these 2 book group discussions, which will take place in Berkeley on September 13th and October 11th. Those are both Thursdays from 7 to 9 p.m. So Thursday evenings, 7 to 9 p.m., September 13th and October 11th at a location in Berkeley to be determined. I will facilitate. I will help guide. Well, you know, actually, I'm just going to facilitate. I'm not going to guide. I want this to be a mutual exploration. I will and have done some research. I like to do research whenever I'm part of a book club or book group into what we're reading and what we'll be reading. So I will have on hand some insights I've gleaned from various sources. But this book group is all about us sharing our own impressions of this masterwork by Dostoevsky. So a $300 pledge to KPFA gets you that experience with me as your companion, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Again, a $300 pledge gets you the book, Notes from Underground, and the two book group discussions on the two Thursdays in September and October, as I mentioned, September 13th and October 11th, Thursday evenings. So it's 4 hours altogether for the two-hour book group sessions, again, and the novel. $300. $200 gets you Voices That Change the World, which is really this incredible compilation of amazing presentations and performances. If you're wondering why September and October for this book group discussion, it's to give you time to get the book from us and to look it over. And I know some folks, including myself, are sometimes on vacation over the summer. So we all come back in September and October, and we have read some of this. It's a fairly short novel, actually, in two parts. So we'll have read you know, at least the first half of the book by the first session and the second half of the book by the second session. So, again, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. If I can shift back to Voices That Change the World, I will hear a little bit more from that compilation in just a moment. It has a number of sections, you know, 1,300-plus hours. That's a lot of audio. So it's been sort of divided into sections. You get it on a USB drive, by the way. There is a Black History section. There is a Women's History section. There are, as I mentioned, a number of audiobooks. There is a section on Grammy restored recordings, performances by contemporary musicians, classical musicians. There is a radio arts section with people like with poets, featuring poets and artists and performers. There's a section on the free speech movement. There's a section on religious studies, including a number of Buddhist thinkers. There is a section of Dr. Michio Kaku's exploration program, featuring him and a number of his guests. And there are over 500, yes, I said over 500 one-hour radio documentaries covering some of the most important events of the last five, six decades, featuring voices like those of Noam Chomsky, Ray Bradbury, Alice Walker, Allen Ginsberg, Adrienne Rich, and hundreds more. It's an amazing compilation. If you haven't picked it up, it's a $200 pledge to KPFA. You can break that down into six equal monthly installments. The same with the $300 pledge thank you gift of the book group discussions and the book. You can break that down into six equal installments of $50 each. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 12 slots only for the two-session book discussion. Once they are gone, they are gone. So if you're thinking of procrastinating, if you're intrigued, if you're interested, if you'd like to join us, love to have you, then call sooner rather than later. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. I wouldn't want you to call and ask for that and to be told that all the slots have filled. 1-800-439-5732. We have time for a little bit more of this audiobook, which is part of Voices That Change the World, part of that compilation. Here again is the actor Stacy Keach reading from Notes from Underground by Dostoevsky.
It goes without saying that my friendship with my office colleagues never lasted long. In no time, I fell out with them, and being young and inexperienced, I even stopped saying good morning to them and cut them dead. Actually, I went that far only once. But in general, I was alone almost all the time. At home, I mostly read. I had to drown out the clamor in me, and reading was the only available way. Reading, of course, was helpful. It stirred, delighted, and tormented me. Now and then, however, I grew terribly tired of it. I became restless and plunged not into real debauchery, but into murky, sordid, petty dissipation. My petty passion stabbed and burned me because I was already on edge. I suffered hysterical outbursts of tears and convulsions. Aside from my reading, I had nothing to turn to, for there was nothing in my surroundings that I could look up to that attracted me. I was sick of everything and longed to contradict and oppose. So I abandoned myself to dissipation. But I haven't brought this up to justify myself at all. No, that's a lie. I was trying to justify myself, all right. I note that for myself, ladies and gentlemen, I've promised myself that I won't lie here. I indulged in vice at night, stealthily, fearfully, sordidly. The feeling of shame was always present, and in the most unspeakable moments, it was like damnation itself. Even then, I carried this hole in the floor of my heart. I was terribly afraid to be seen and recognized, and I went to the lowest haunts. Once, passing by a tavern, I saw some men fighting with billiard cues through a lighted window. One of them was tossed out of the window. At another time, a scene like that would have made me sick, but this time I envied that ejected gentleman so much that I entered the tavern and stepped into the billiard room thinking, maybe I could pick a fight too and be thrown out of the window. As a matter of fact, I wasn't drunk. That's how far despair can drive a man. But nothing came of it. I couldn't even manage to be tossed out of a window, and I left without picking a fight. An officer who happened to be there put me in my place immediately. I was standing by the billiard table, inadvertently blocking the officer's way. He grabbed me by the shoulders and, without a word, picked me up and, setting me down a bit further away, passed by as if I didn't exist. I could have forgiven anything, including a beating, but that was too much to be brushed aside without being noticed. I don't know what I wouldn't have given at that moment for a real quarrel, a decent one, something more literary, if you know what I mean. I'd been treated as one treats a fly. The officer was a husky six-footer, and I'm very small and thin, but it wasn't still within my power to start trouble. All I had to do was make the smallest protest, and I'd have gone right through the window. But I changed my mind and decided to merge, full of rage, into the background. I left the tavern ashamed and troubled and returned home. The following night, I went out to satisfy my petty vices. I moved even more furtively, was shyer, sadder, more abject than before. But I went. Don't think, however, that I backed down before that officer out of cowardice. I've never been a coward at heart, although I've constantly acted like a coward when the chips were down.
That's Stacy Keach reading from Fyodor Dostoevsky's masterwork, Notes from Underground, an amazing novel. It has been called Dostoevsky's most revolutionary novel, one in which he strikes upon timeless truths. It's been called a political critique and a powerful, at times absurdly comical, account of man's breakaway from society. An amazing work published in 1864. And if you would like to meet with me twice in September and October on two Thursdays to talk for a total of 4 hours about this book, two sessions, 2 hours each on September, I want to make sure I get this right, September 13th and October 11th in the evening in Berkeley, then that is a $300 pledge. You can participate in those two discussions and get your own copy of Notes from Underground sent to you. Those are your thank you gifts for a $300 pledge to KPFA, which comes to $50 a month over 6 months, if you like. For a $200 pledge, you can get Voices That Change the World, which features not only all of the voices that we presented this hour, but hundreds more in historic recordings. This is probably our best value thank you gift of our entire fund drive. Imagine getting 1,300 plus hours for a pledge of $200 to KPFA. That information and insight right there is probably worth much more than the $200 you'll be giving, and that's not even $200 because we have tax deduction, right? That charitable contributions are tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Again, a $300 pledge gets you a chance to talk with me and about 12 other people about this amazing book, Notes from Underground. I've joined a number of book groups or book groupings over the last few years, and I always really enjoy them. It's not just a chance to talk about great literature, but a chance to meet people, a chance to talk about books, which I love, and I know many of you love, to talk about ideas. Dostoevsky, one of the great novelists of ideas, in so many of his novels, he's really conveying ideas, elaborating on them, and trying to inform and often provoke the listener, the reader, excuse me. Let me read from the book jacket of the copy of Notes from Underground that you'll get if you go for the $300 combo pack of two book group discussions plus the book. Again, 1-800-439-5732. Notes from Underground is considered the author's first masterpiece. Richard Peviar, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and Larissa Volokonsky, whose acclaimed translations of other books by Dostoevsky, now give us a superb new rendering of this early classic, presented as the fictional apology and confession of the underground man, formerly a minor official of mid-19th century Russia, whom Dostoevsky leaves nameless, as one critic wrote, because I, in quotes, is all of us. The novel is divided into two parts. The first, a half-desperate, half-mocking political critique. The second, a powerful, at times absurdly comical account of the man's breakaway from society. The book's extraordinary style, brilliantly violating literary conventions in ways never before attempted, shocked its first readers and still shocks many today. Join me, join a group interested in this book, and get the book as well for a $300 pledge, 1-800-439-5732. Only 12 slots in total. I need to check with the phone room to see how many slots have been filled, but I think you could still call. And don't go online for this one. You need to call 1-800-439-5732. But a number of people have also gone, have instead gone for the Voices That Changed the World compilation. All these amazing, articulate, knowledgeable, incisive, inspiring, talented, incandescent voices. All these thinkers and performers and artists and writers and public intellectuals who are part of this amazing Voices That Changed the World compilation. That's a $200 pledge to KPFA. $200 pledge to KPFA gets you the Voices That Changed the World compilation. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. That comes to you, by the way, in the form of a 64 gig. That's a lot of gigs. 64 gigabyte USB drive with 1,350 hours of amazing audio. And Sasha is sitting alongside, but Sasha, I have been remiss in that I have not yet announced a match. The match has been put up from a listener in Madeira named Sandra. Thank you so much, Sandra. She has given $800 and she needs you all, we need you all in the next 7.5 minutes to come up with $800 to match Sandra, because she decided to give this money conditionally upon other people giving money. So she will double your dollars. So if you want to give $300 for the two-session book discussion on September 13th and October 11th, plus the book Notes from Underground, we get $600 because she doubles your $300 pledge. If you want to give $200 for this incredible, sprawling Voices That Change the World audio compilation, we get $400 because of Sandra. It's a great time to call 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Give us a call, contribute to KPFA, and get some great thank you gifts in return.
1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. You can also go to kpfa.org, but do call if you're calling to pledge for the combination of the book and the two-session book discussion with CS in September and October. That can be yours for a $300 pledge of support to KPFA. If you can afford $500 right now or $1,000, that would be wonderful. And if you can afford $25, that would be wonderful as well, especially since right now, thanks to Sandra, your dollars are doubled. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And this, the main thank you gift on offer today, is just, I think, fantastic. I have to admit that I just adore Dostoevsky, and the chance to read this book and then have a discussion with C.S. Song, you can't go wrong with that. In fact, how could you do better than that? It's a wonderful opportunity, but there are only 12 slots. We don't know if they are filled. Since we haven't heard, I'm assuming there's at least one slot open. So I'm hoping you will call right now, 1-800-439-5732, and pledge $300 and get this wonderful opportunity to have a literate discussion with C.S., who's such, I have to admit, since we share an office, and a fascinating conversationalist. You get to chat with C.S., you get to hear his insights, the insights of other people in the group, you get to read Dostoevsky, and you get to support KPFA. Really, you couldn't do better than that. But the only catch is you have to do it right now. I don't think this thank you gift will be offered after the next 4 minutes, so that's it. If you want to sign up for it, now is the time. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And we're also offering on USB drive Voices That Change the World. You heard a sampling of some of the vast amount of material, the staggering amount of material that is on in that collection. Yours for a $200 pledge. Listening to Stacy Keach reading Notes from Underground, I thought that was such a... What a wonderful way to engage with the ideas and the words of Dostoevsky when read so majestically by him. It's brilliant. Anyway, this is the time to do it. I hope you will step forward for us right now. Give what you can, whatever you can afford. We don't want to put you into the poorhouse here, but if you can afford to give a large amount, we're certainly grateful for that, because this is the second to last day that Against the Grain will be coming to you during this fund drive. We really need to hear from you. $800 is on the line right now, 1-800-439-5732.
Right. The fund drive ends, as far as we know, on Friday. So if you've been waiting, if you've been hemming, if you've been hawing, it's going to be over before you know it. So why not step forward right now and ask for one of these thank you gifts, 1-800-439-5732. I shake my head every time I look at the list of voices that are part of this Voices That Change the World collection. People like, even within just the Black History section, John Coltrane, Billie Holiday, Nelson Mandela, Rosa Parks, Huey Newton, and then, in other sections, Lily Tomlin and Helen Caldicott and Allen Ginsberg and Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Gore Vidal, who you might have heard on this program last week, because we featured this last week, Joan Baez and Mario Savio and Toni Morrison and Judy Chicago and Gary Snyder and D.T. Suzuki and Alan Watts and Russell Means and Philip Agee and Dick Gregory and Ray Kurzweil. It just goes on and on. It's incredible, the breadth and depth of this compilation, yours for a $200 pledge. But we've got 2.5 minutes left to make this match of $800 from Sandra. We're not asking for $800 from you. If you give $25, it'll be doubled by Sandra. If you give $60, it'll be doubled by Sandra. And you can ask for a thank you gift. In fact, many thank you gifts are a lot. A lot of thank you gifts are listed right there at kpfa.org. You can do a little shopping if you want. Maybe you want to give and not ask for a thank you gift. Maybe you want to give $300 or more and ask for this two-session book discussion with me and 12 other people, 11 other people interested in Dostoevsky, interested in classic literature, interested in this iconic novel of ideas. And you also get the book that we will be looking at, 1-800-439-5732. The book, of course, being Notes from Underground. Sasha, we have 90 seconds left. I have no idea whether we made that match. I think there are still slots open for this two-session book discussion. Give us a call. It's not too late to call.
Give us a call right now and get this opportunity while you can, while it's on offer, which is about to end. We have basically just over 60 seconds to go. $800 is on the line, this conditional pledge from Sandra and Madeira. So please, please, won't you call us right now? Your money is doubled, but it's conditional that the entire amount is matched by listeners, so it's really an all or nothing. Won't you be the person who puts us over the top right now, because We have no idea if we've made the match, and we really, really need to do so. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA and kpfa.org. You're what keeps us going, and you get so much in return. Just think what you get if you pledge right now for either Voices That Change the World on USB drive or the two-book discussion of notes from underground. You will get a wonderful experience, something that you can cherish. Beyond that, you get KPFA, you get a tax deduction, and right now you get your dollars matched by Sandra. Only 10 seconds left to go.
We made that match, Sasha.
Oh,
thank you to all who called.
Thank you all so much. Keep
calling and giving the KPFA.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.